We have a number of bills today, and there are a lot of policy committees that are meeting long and extra shifts. So there may be members of the committee that will be leaving for important votes in other committees. We hope to get through all of this today, preferably during our afternoon session, so we don't have to go into the evening, but we are prepared to go on if need be. We will be taking testimony on all the bills up to the omnibus bill, and we will be presenting the omnibus bill today, but we will be taking testimony on it on Thursday. So we'll give you time to take a look at it, and then if you wish to testify, it's important that you let Jenny, the committee administrator, know so that we can put you on the schedule for Thursday. And the first bill up is House File 532, Senator Erickson Ropes. This is a House file because it was passed in the House, and we're working off of that bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. I'm happy to be here today presenting this bill. Between the House and the Senate, this bill has been through 8 committees and has had no objections. So hopefully it'll just sail right through quickly on your
Senator
committee
Erickson
as well.
Ropes, yes. I just want to indicate that we do have a quorum present.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'll just remind the committee quickly that the this bill has to do with military service personnel and contracts that they get into. This one is particularly concerned with telecommunications and some utilities contracts. There is a federal act called the Service Members Civil Relief Act that provides certain protections for members of the military who are in active duty. And because of federal emergencies, get exclusion from some contracts that they've written. But the federal bill fails to protect service members from a few important contracts. For example, while the SCRA protects members from eviction, it fails to protect them from being disconnected from utilities like gas and electric. And we all know people nowadays have cell phones and other contracts. So this bill will offer protection for active duty members to terminate without penalty their wireless service contracts, to also terminate any rental contracts they have for copy machines, contracts related to their businesses, memberships in clubs, and that sort of thing, also to obtain payment arrangements for utility services and protection from shutoff. So I have with me Brian Bergson from the Attorney General's office to field any questions you have.
It's not Al Junkie today.
No.
And in the Commerce Committee, Mr. Bergson was introduced as Al Junkie.
Madam Chairman, Brian Bergson from the Attorney General's office. I'm still in therapy over that.
Oh, sorry.
Welcome, Mr. Bergson. Do you have comments, or are you just here for questions? And any questions about the bill? Really pretty straightforward. It for active duty members, it allows them to get out of their contracts and prohibits any penalties. Is there anybody that wishes to move the bill?
I'll move the bill, Madam Chair.
Goes to judiciary. So
I will move House File 532 be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Judiciary.
Thank you, Senator Dibble. Any questions or comments about the bill?
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Senjan.
I haven't read the bill. I'm trying to scurry through the summary, and maybe it says here, but I guess my question would be how far does, you know, for instance, a home mortgage, something like that, would the purchase of a car?
Senator Senjan and Madam Chair.
Senator Erickson Ropes.
Those items would be covered by federal law.
Okay.
This is more limited to smaller contracts, the cell phone contracts. If there is a service member who's a small business owner, is called up for duty, and he's got contracts for copy machines in his office, okay. This would allow him to get out of those kinds of contracts. Sports club memberships, things like that.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions or comments? Okay, then, on Senator Dibble's motion that House File 532 be recommended to pass and referred to Judiciary, all those in favor, please signify by stating aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members.
Great job.
Thank you. God, I got too many.
And we next, Senator Rosen, 2053.
Madam Chair.
Senator Rest.
In my own committee, I got in some trouble by not recognizing that a bill had been amended in a prior committee. And is that a problem when we just pass the bill as opposed to passing it as previously amended? Maybe your counsel knows.
I don't know, Senator Rest. I didn't know that we had to say that it was amended because we're working off the engrossment, I'm assuming.
Well,
but
I know,
maybe
but
not.
The third engrossment we have indicates that in the past it has been amended. And so I'm just curious because passing House File 532 means that we pass it as introduced, as far as I'm concerned.
Okay.
That's what I was told.
Mr. Fuller.
Well, Madam Chair, Senator Rest, this is the first time I've heard that question, but I think what we have in our committee is what came to it, which is the House third engrossment. So when we report it back to the floor, that's what will go there. And so when we report it back, I mean, we don't have, in other words, you don't have to say it's as amended, it wouldn't hurt, but the paperwork will be that bill that's on the floor.
Well, Madam Chair, Mr. Fuller, we thought we
Senator
had done
Rest.
That too, and it ended up that was not the case. And the bill got reported to the floor as introduced rather than with the amendments on it. So I'm a little bit gun-shy of not recognizing that when it happens again.
Well, Madam Chair, I'd say that was a clerical error, but if you want to reconsider your vote and move it as amended because somehow
don't have
that
to
may
do
happen.
That, but I just was curious.
Okay. Thank you, Senator Dibble.
Thank you. That's a great Peter Watson question. I wonder if it makes a difference if it's oh really?
File.
Oh, so this comes from on high from me. I wonder if it makes a difference if it's a Senate file or a House file too. So okay, well, we have a further inquiry for Mr. Watson.
Okay, Senator Rosen, welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair and fellow members. I have before you Senate File 2053. And basically, Madam Chair, it's a propane pre-purchase program providing consumer protection. Last year, Senator Metzen and I worked on a pre-buy program for propane, delivered fuel. And it was and it's going to be successful. And I had the bill again this year for appropriations in front of Senator Anderson's committee. But basically, this is something that needs to be done. It's initiating language for the appropriations bill that hopefully will pass this year. This, as amended, this bill did pass the House, and it ensures that whoever administers the program, that the program will continue and that the LIHEAP resources are used effectively. Madam Chair, I do have the A1 amendment. I'd like to move, please.
Okay, this is in your file, members. And Senator Rosen moves. And Senator Rosen, I'm confused. This is the first time the bill is being heard?
This is the first time this has been heard, yes.
Okay. So this is an author's amendment then?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. Senator Rosen moves the A1 amendment. Any questions? All those in favor signify by stating aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Senator Rosen.
Madam Chair, just briefly on the amendment, it deals with the consumer protections and discrimination part of it. So we're deleting Section 2, replacing it with language, basically real good language that makes sure that there is no discrimination for anybody that's on LIHEAP. The bill, what I like about it is that the Department of Commerce will contract to operate in propane pre-purchase fuel program. So we had the bill for the appropriations come through first, but now this is the language to make sure that it's used effectively. And also there will be a report that's due out June 30th of 08 that will talk about the cost of gallon of the pre-purchased fuel, the total gallons of fuel pre-purchased, and the average cost of propane each month between October and following April. and if there's any savings that have been incurred through that. So we are trying to use this money, this federal money, more effectively, and I think this is one of the important tools to make sure that we can service more customers out there. And, Madam Chair, I have with me Ms. Pam Marshall that would like to say a few words.
Okay. Ms. Marshall.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members. The bill before you, as amended, did pass and was a part of the omnibus energy bill last year. And as Senator Rosen suggested, independent of any potential state supplement or appropriation, so that we could purchase propane with state dollars and not take away from the federal energy assistance program in order to do so, even without any state supplement, we believe it's appropriate to use those federal dollars as wisely as possible and enable the department to buy propane when those prices are historically lower in the summer on behalf of those households who heat with propane and participate in the energy assistance program. Just very briefly in terms of need, last year about 133,000 households did receive federal energy assistance in Minnesota, 19% of whom heat their homes with propane. Because of the increase in fuel prices, an energy assistance grant purchases about 26% of the propane required for a heating season. 5 years ago, that grant purchased 38% of the propane needed for to get through an entire heating season. And since the winter of 2002, retail propane prices have increased 82%. So, again, whatever we can do to buy that propane in aggregate when the price is lower and allow the energy assistance grant that is available to those households that heat with propane to purchase all that much more fuel after October 1st when the energy assistance program begins, we think we need to do that. And in doing so, we can bolster the effectiveness of the federal energy assistance dollar. Again, this language was included in the omnibus energy bill last year, and we are asking for your support again this year.
Thank you. Any questions or comments? Senator Rosen.
Madam Chair, I'm hoping that this bill can be moved straight to the floor.
Yes.
Is that correct? Okay.
Yes.
Madam Chair and members, I move that Senate File 2053 be recommended to pass.
As amended.
As amended. And
referred to the floor.
Yeah, thank you. Still on used to break.
Any questions or comments about the motion? Okay, then on Senator Rosen's motion, all those in favor, please signify by stating aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members.
Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Now, are you
going to Senator Anderson.
Okay. I won't go. Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. Senate File 1998 is an intervenor compensation bill, and what this will do is update and improve the current law that we have on the books that allows for advocates for consumers to participate in a rate case and to get recovery for that, the cost of that intervention or that participation to represent the public interest and the consumer point of view in rate cases up to a certain limit. And we have an author's amendment that I'd like to make sure that, well, I'd like to offer that amendment, put that on the bill, because what it does is narrows the bill as originally drafted to be clear that it will only apply to interveners in rate cases, which has been, and with that amendment, there is no opposition that I'm aware of to this bill. So I would move the A1 amendment, and Mr. Fuller, if you want, could explain any of the other differences in the amendment. But essentially, there's some technical differences, but primarily what it does, this is the same language as almost entirely as adopted in the House with one technical change. But essentially what it does in particular is to make it clear that it only applies to rate cases.
Okay. Senator Anderson offers the A1 amendment, which is an author's amendment.
And Madam Chair, could we just have Mr. Fuller just explain what the other technical changes are in the amendment briefly?
Sure. Mr. Fuller?
I think the only one that would have to do with the ones on 1.13 to 1.19. And my understanding, and this has been worked out with the revisor's office, is my understanding, is that the underlying rules were originally repealed, but it turns out that they also apply to telephone utility issues. So they have an ongoing application. So what this does, what this says is it directs the PUC to make conforming amendments to the rules to accommodate this section and to use a procedure that allows for less process. So that's the good cause exception, which would apply anyway by force of its own language, but it just directs them to go that route. So that's the reason for that language and why they're just not repealed. And I think the policy reason was they didn't want people to read the rules and think that they apply to gas and electric when they don't. So that's why they directed them to amend them.
Okay. Senator Anderson, anything further?
No. I would move the A1 amendment.
Okay. Then on the on Senator Anderson's motion to adopt the A1 amendment, all those in favor, please signify by stating aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails.
So, Madam Chair, just briefly to explain why we need this bill. As members may or may not know, when a utility brings a rate case forward to increase electric rates or gas rates, they can recover the costs of their participation, their lawyers, you know, their technical staff, which usually is about $1 million worth of cost to come to the Public Utilities Commission and ask for a rate increase. We've allowed them by law to recover those costs. We also allow limited participation on behalf of the consumers to be compensated as well by ratepayers. We know that increased utility rates disproportionately affect low and moderate income people, and advocates for their ability to pay these increased rates are the voice that's the least likely to participate in those types of proceedings. Obviously, the Chamber of Commerce participates on behalf of business customers and has a consumer perspective from the large customer point of view. But the residential low-income ratepayer who has to pay their electric or their heat bill needs to have this representation. And we know that in recent years there's been a large number of rate cases with rate increases proposed, and the Energy Sense Coalition is an organization that goes into the proceedings and provides a voice for those consumers to make sure that their concerns are represented in that decision-making process. And that's been recognized by Minnesota law for a long time. I don't know how many years this has been on the books. But what we're trying to do is update the law because there's some provisions in it that are out of date and are really inflexible, and so we'll make it work better. And so I'll let Ms. Marshall from the Energy Sense Coalition tell you about the details about the changes. Would you do that?
Ms. Marshall.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Again, Pam Marshall and I do represent low and fixed income ratepayers as the director of the Energy Sense Coalition. And since 1992, our organization has participated in one form or another in each of the major utility rate cases. I believe that was four since 1992. Since the fall of 2005, we've been in three, and a fourth is coming during the fall of 2007. So they're coming a lot more rapidly than they did. It's, to the best of my knowledge, the $20,000 cap on compensation hasn't been raised since 1993, and it may very well have been before that, but that's when the first time I was aware of it. As Senator Anderson said, the current rules require a preliminary determination of compensation, and then after the close of the 10 to 12 month rate case proceeding, there is a final determination that's based both on whether or not an intervening party materially assisted the commission in their deliberations and in the outcomes of a rate case, and on whether or not that party demonstrated financial hardship. This bill retains the threshold for materially assist. You have to be a formal party. You have to be granted formal intervener party status, and you do have to contribute to the outcome of a case. That remains the same. There is a minor change in the way in which financial hardship is defined. Current law defines it, but for the absence of this award, you would not have participated in the case. That isn't exactly a standard that is very easy to meet, and certainly not in every utility case. There are times where we can participate in a more limited way, and other times when we want to be a party in, on a whole array of issues. The change in the bill that's before you merely says the commission has to consider the relationship between an organization's restricted and unrestricted funds, and the burden is on the intervener to show why the intervener can't use more of their revenue for participation in the case. I think it's the last thing I want to say is that it is important to remember that the $50,000 is a cap. Even with the current $20,000, we're in the most recent Xcel Electric rate case, and we were participating on a very narrow set of issues, submitted a claim for compensation of $8,300. In the most recent CenterPoint case, however, we spent well over the $20,000 cap. We spent $27,000, and that was relying only on internal staff and not being able to hire outside expert witnesses like other parties do. And so, actually, so that was the last thing. That was the second to last thing. The last thing is that our organization is often the only non-governmental, if not the only, non-governmental residential, and in particular low and fixed income residential representative throughout those proceedings. We prepare testimony, we prepare cross-examination, we prepare briefs. We're in those proceedings for 10 to 12 months, and we think the changes as proposed in this bill will help our organization and others participate more effectively in the rate cases.
I would say, Madam Chair, that I would guess that most of our constituents probably don't know that they pay utilities to advocate for raising their rates. And so I think this gives them comfort to know that they also would pay a very small price to help make sure that their interests are represented when it comes to the level of the rates that are considered acceptable. So, Madam Chair, as I said, there's no opposition that I'm aware of to this bill, and I would be open for any questions.
Senator Vanderveer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Anderson, I don't have any opposition to the bill, but it occurred to me, looking at this, that the intervener, maybe you could just describe typically who a typical intervener is.
Can you help?
Ms. Marshall.
Madam Chair and Senator, in my experience, for example, I'll go back to, I think it was 97. I might have my years wrong, but in the Minnesota Power rate case, for example, the only non-governmental consumer organization I was aware of other than the large industrial interveners was the Northeast Senior Coalition, for example. And then my organization, I was a witness on their behalf so that both of us didn't intervene. The formal party was the Senior Coalition. In the last two three now, both the Xcel Electric and Xcel Gas and CenterPoint rate cases, the one and only non-governmental representative and intervener was my organization acting on behalf of low and fixed income consumers.
Madam Chair, and of course the
Senator
Attorney General's
Anderson.
Office does advocate on behalf of residential consumers in a rate case as well, as from the governmental. But they have a broader kind of, you know, the whole public interest of the whole state of Minnesota ratepayers that they are concerned with.
So, Madam Chair, maybe Senator Anderson, they're typically then these are nonprofits or groups like that. And my concern is now that we're compensating them, I guess the only thing I would wonder is, would it be okay maybe to just add that the organization or individual who is not the recipient of any other public monies as a, just an exclusion of, or, you know, other public bodies, because otherwise we have the Public Utilities Commission paid for by the public. We have the utility who is being, you know, contested on the rate issue by, you know, the private entity, and now we're going to give them the those contesting the case other than the Public Utilities Commission public money also, or money from the utilities again. So the utilities are paying everyone to fight the utilities, so, which, you know, because of their unique situation, it isn't out of the question that that would, you know, would be, could be there when you're a monopoly. But it just seems to me that if we're going to set another group up to be compensated for representing different groups who contest the rates, that we not be doubling up and be giving money to public money to them also and awarding them compensation. Do you see what my concern
is? Yeah, well, Madam Chair,
Senator Anderson.
I don't think there's any, you know, there's no taxpayer money, if that's what you mean by public money. I mean, this is all about ratepayers paying, utilities paying the bill, and ratepayers paying the utilities. So, yes, in a way, we're paying someone to contest the utility, or ratepayers are paying to contest the utilities, but it's in their interest to have a voice when it comes to raising their rates.
Well, Madam Chair, it would be
Senator
Anderson, and I can see that compensating them under these mm-hmm. what appear to be reasonable circumstances could be okay. I'm just saying that if the group is already receiving public money, well, maybe I should ask, is it common that these groups would be receiving public money?
Do you mean, Mr.
Senator Anderson?
Madam Chair, Senator, you mean ratepayer money or you mean tax dollars?
Tax dollars.
You mean like the Energy Sense Coalition? Are you asking if they receive any public dollars?
If that's
or
one of
any of the
Madam
other
Chair.
Innovators?
Senator Vanderbilt.
Senator Anderson,
no
if that's one of the groups, yes. Do they receive other public funds?
Ms. Marshall?
Madam Chair and Senator, no, we don't receive public funds. We often attempt to raise private foundation money to supplement our participation in the rate cases, but and it's my understanding that the resources for the Attorney General's office and the Department of Commerce as interveners by statute in utility rate cases obviously receive public funding to play that role in rate cases and in other proceedings before the Public Utilities Commission. But my organization, and to the best of my knowledge, no private intervener, at least in any rate case, they don't receive public funding to participate. Once the commission has determined that there is a financial hardship that's been demonstrated and that a party has materially assisted in a case, they then order the utility to compensate the costs that have been documented for that organization's participation, and it's the utility company that then reimburses the intervener party for participation in a rate case.
So,
Senator Vanderveer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So the only one impacted would be the Attorney General. Do we, and that office is funded, correct? And, you know, by the legislature. And I'm wondering, would this be something different if this is passed? That would the Attorney General potentially be compensated, or would that not occur with this legislation?
Ms. Marshall?
Well, Madam Chair, this bill simply makes a couple of changes to current law, and that is raising the cap of compensation and streamlining the rules. And so the Attorney General's office is not compensated for rate case participation under the current law and wouldn't be under the proposed language.
So maybe, Madam Chair, Senator Anderson, an amendment like that wouldn't be needed probably because it sounds like these are all privately funded groups that would probably be taking this advocacy role.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, Senator, I believe that's correct.
Ms. Marshall or Senator Anderson, is it typical that there's more than one intervener that would receive compensation in a rate case?
Go ahead. Well, I think Ms. Marshall said in the some of them they've been the only in most of them they've been the only intervener, private intervener. But in there was a senior advocacy organization.
Yeah. And in that case, did both your organization and the Senior Federation, or would they, do they qualify for, do they split
well,
the pot?
There's pretty strict criteria in here about that you have to meet to be eligible. And that's part of what is being clarified here. I mean, you have to materially add to the, let's see the language, to the discussion and the ability of the Public Utilities Commission to make a good reasoned decision. And so, you know, it's not like you can just go in and make an argument. You have to show that your participation made a difference and provided information that was critical for them to have in front of them before they would even, and there's a number of other steps that have to be proven.
Ms. Marshall.
Madam Chair and members, in the example I offered about the most recent, long time ago, Minnesota Power case, I participated as a witness on behalf of the Senior Coalition, and the only party that then submitted a claim for compensation was the Senior Coalition. It was granted, as I recall. But as Senator Anderson indicated, there the language retains the language from the current law that would basically disallow redundancy in the positions of parties so that if legal services and our organization and the Senior Federation and others were to make the same arguments to the Public Utilities Commission, it would be very difficult for each of those organizations to claim a unique perspective, which is one of the bases for seeking compensation.
Okay. Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On this subject, I had a question about line 2.7, number 5, that the position advocated by the intervener has to have been adopted or in whole or in part by the commission or the administrative law judge. I'm just concerned, Madam Chair and Senator Anderson, I'm wondering if that provision is locked down or if that's just informative to the decision. I don't know. That seems a little too strict, in my opinion, because all those other conditions may have been satisfied and it may have been very, very important to have that information presented to the proceeding. Mm-hmm. But for whatever reason, you know, the position advocated by the intervener was not adopted by the ALJ or the commission, and I'm wondering how important that provision is, or if it's just something that they take into consideration. They don't actually have to abide by fully every aspect.
Madam Chair, Senator Dibble, I think that's a good question. It sounds really harsh that you have to win in order to get paid, you know, essentially. But it's not. It's number one, that's current law. So we're just restating it in this form because we're moving things from rules to statutes, just incorrect. Uh-huh. And also it says that it's part of the consideration. So they don't have to meet every one of these criteria. But the PUC, if you look on page 1, line 20, it says, in determining whether an intervener has materially assisted the commission's deliberation, the commission must consider all of these factors. And then they also have to consider financial hardship. So I don't know, Ms. Marshall. Has
Madam
that
Chair,
been a
maybe,
barrier?
Yeah, maybe I can
Senator
understand.
Dibble.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The what the experience has been. Have you always succeeded at least nudging or tilting or creating, you know, some inclination of the LG or the Commission to throw you a bone, and so you can fully claim compensation, or you know, have you been totally shut out and not been able to claim any compensation?
Madam Chair and Senator Dibble, it would depend on the case that we were talking about, but I think it's important that we do start at the very beginning of that section because under C, the 1 through 5, and the number 5 is the one you're referring to, mm-hmm. All speak to whether or not there has been material assistance. So they're really deciding the material assistance part of this consideration, and they're looking at 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. So do you have to be a part of the ALJ's recommendations in order to be determined to have material assisted? No. If you are a fully participating intervener on a wide array of issues in a rate case, is it likely that you will there will be other parties who agree with the position and end up being adopted by the ALJ? Yes.
Okay. All right. Well,
Senator Rest.
That helps. So if you don't think it needs to come out of there, then I won't make that motion.
Well, okay. Senator Rest.
Madam Chair and Senator Dibble, Senator Anderson, I read that the same way as Senator Dibble, and the part that is bothersome is that on line 1.21 it says as a minimum that this must be considered. If it just read the commission must consider whether, then that means that all or some, probably not none, but all or some of them must be considered, but it's not a minimum that occurred. And I would wonder whether striking those words at a minimum gets to the concern that Senator Dibble was raising about lines 2.7 and 2.8. And just because it's coming from another part of the law or coming out of the rules doesn't mean that we can't do what we want here. Senator Anderson, Madam Chair.
Do you want to say something?
I don't know what it does to the lack of opposition.
Madam Chair.
Senator Anderson.
I certainly like what you're trying to do. Mm-hmm. I just don't know if that would create issues with the bill,
okay.
If that would raise some opposition. I don't know, but I think you're right.
Well,
personally.
Madam Chair, what is the status of this bill in the House? And, I mean, do you have any working relationship with them about whether this would cause you problems with the House version of it? I wouldn't want to do that, but it seems to me that the at a minimum is objectionable.
Okay. Madam Chair, we're thinking it's in
Senator
Representative
Anderson.
Slocum is the author, and we believe, well, I guess we don't know. It's either on the floor or in the finance omnibus bill. I don't know.
Madam Chair.
Senator Rest.
I'm going to offer an amendment then to on lines 121 to delete comma and the phrase at a minimum in the second comma. I guess it's actually the second and third comma.
You want to remove at a minimum on page and both both commas, right?
Yep. Second and third commas and the phrase at a minimum.
Okay. On line 1.21. Senator Anderson.
So just, Madam Chair, Senator Rush, you just want to take out at a minimum?
Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry. I was thinking you wanted to take out the section, the other paragraph. Yeah, I don't think that does any harm, or I think that's fine. It makes it perhaps a little clearer.
They awarded it.
Madam Chair.
Senator Hope. Coke.
Thank you. Well, my question only there would be, are we limiting then the things that can be considered.
Uh-huh.
That is my concern, that this is not, that is the only concern with taking out at a minimum. Are we limiting what can be considered? Were they trying to leave that language sort of open-ended so that these are things we could consider in addition, you know, as well
as well as other things that might come from a case, and I can't even think offhand what that might be. But but I just have a little concern about taking out at a minimum, and maybe the words we're looking for are something different here. But must consider these and other, or including but not limited to, something like that.
Ms. Marshall, how long has the bill, how long has this been in statute, and how long has it worked for you, or has it worked for you?
Madam Chair, I'm not exactly sure when the statute was first enacted. I know that the $20,000 cap hasn't been raised since 93, so it's been around a while before that. And my history ends there, so I'm not sure the evolution of the language before then. I believe the phrase at a minimum was lifted from the current rules. I know that the list, 1 through 5 there, is a part of the current rules, and I, too, am hard-pressed to come up with anything that they would consider in addition to this. And so I'm not sure for practical purposes from our perspective that it makes a whole lot of difference whether to keep it or to strike it.
But Ms. Marshall, my question is,
I'll withdraw the amendment.
Senator Rest is withdrawing the amendment, but my question is, has it been a hindrance for you in the past, or is there any reason to change that language?
Madam Chair, no, I don't think so.
Okay. So Senator Rest withdraws the amendment. Senator Dibble.
Well, not to belabor the point, but I will. on line 21, what would be the effect? Maybe I'll direct this to counsel, of changing the word must to the word may. So then that preserves the at a minimum concerns that Senator Koch raised, allows the consideration to be a little less locked down.
Mr. Fuller, Madam Chair, Senator Dibble, you want to pull your mic around?
My understanding of Senator Koch's point is that she might be interested on line 21 deleting at a minimum and insert something like among other factors, so it would read commission must consider among other factors whether, and then that would be open-ended. Then it's open-ended both ways, as you understand. I mean, it would be open-ended to award compensation and open-ended not to award compensation.
Is that your motion, Senator Polk?
I think I will move that.
All right.
That's the wording that I would like to insert, right. So I'll make that motion.
Awesome. And Senator Dibble, how do you?
I'll support that, Madam Chair.
Okay. Madam Chair, I think that's
Senator Anderson.
Sensible.
Are there other questions or comments about that?
We're not doing May. Just doing among other things, right?
And so the language would be, Mr. Fuller.
Madam Chair, on line 21 of page 1, delete at a minimum and insert among other factors. So it would read, the commission must consider among other factors whether, and then the list.
Okay, Senator Koch makes that motion. All those in favor, please signify by stating aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. Senator Anderson.
All right, Madam Chair. If there's no further discussion, I would move that Senate File 1998 as amended be recommended to pass and hopefully go to the floor. Mm-hmm. Senator Rest, do you need to see it? Okay. Are you going to be able to see it this week? Well, we didn't realize it had to go to your committee because I don't think in the House.
It deals extensively, Madam Chair and Senator Anderson, with rulemaking. So, yes, indeed it does. We will do our best.
Okay.
We're meeting both Wednesday and Thursday.
Thank you. Well, that's what my motion will be. That's the Chair's request.
Okay, and I apologize on the previous bills that I neglected to ask if there was anybody that wished to testify before the committee on the bill. Is there on this bill anybody that wishes to testify from the audience?
Madam Chair.
Senator Senjum.
Madam Chair, this is new to me. It's strange to me. So we're putting together a program, it looks like, for interveners, and we've had one, I guess, to elevate the max to $50,000, and got some criteria here. But on the other hand, we've got a program here which suggests that the $50,000 competitor compete with the $1 million utility. on a rate case, and both are reimbursed perhaps up to that level, and then we're expecting, I don't know, fairness or a good decision. I'm not trying to almost be flippant, but I'm not sure I could go back to Rochester to my Hy-Vee grocery store restaurant and explain this very well, the standpoint of how government works. And so that's basically the case. Everybody gets paid. We've got the Public Utilities Commission, which I thought was supposed to represent, if you will, the people, but they're not able to, and apparently the utilities aren't able to represent themselves. And then we need interveners to, we need to bring interveners along and pay them, obviously, if you will, to represent the ratepayers. But I don't know, there's just something funny about all this to me. But can I, Madam Chair, just as a for instance, my own local municipal utility would, if there were somebody in my community that wanted to be involved in a rate case in my community relative to a rate case increase in my community, and they wanted to be involved in this process and be an intervener, I don't know how you sign up, but if they wanted to do that, would they be as eligible for this program as anybody else?
Madam Mr. Chair, Senator Sengem, Senator first Anderson. I would say, I mean, you make some very good points here, and I think Ms. Marshall, I'm just whispering to her, and she said, for utilities, there's no cap set in statute or in rule, but they just request recovery, I think her estimate was $1 million. I don't know whether that's ballpark or what. I think for a municipal utility, they're not rate regulated at the PUC, so okay. They would have to go to their local muni board and try to. I don't know how that participation process works, honestly. When there's a rate increase, I don't know how that what the process is involved in that. It's a good question. I should know, but I don't.
So, Ms. Marshall, does this reply or what is it? Relate only to the investor-owned utilities?
Madam Chair, yes.
Okay. And Madam Chair, Senator Sengem, you make a really good point. I mean, I'm not sure why it costs.
Madam Chair
and
Senator
amount.
Anderson,
Senator Sengem.
I'm just trying to, I don't understand what seems to be a convoluted process, but it must work. So, you know, trust your government.
Okay. What? That would be us.
Any further questions or comments? Then Senator Anderson renews her motion that Senate File 1998 as amended be recommended to pass and re-referred to State and Local Government Operations and Oversight Committee.
I've already begged her for another bill.
All those in favor, please signify by stating aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
Thank you.
Prevails.
My name still has to go there soon.
Senator Anderson, you have 2041.
2041, yes. That'd be great to do that one next. Okay, let's see. Okay, great. Yeah. Hi, Lori. How are you? Yeah.
See you.
You too. Yes, good. Are you the general manager? Is that the right title? Finally figured it out.
Senior okay. VP and general manager.
And senior VP. Okay. All my notes here. Madam Chair and members, this bill, Senate File 2041, relates to the Rock 10 company that is in the Midway area of St. Paul on University, right off University Avenue in the Midway area. It's a recycling plant that recycles cardboard and recycles half of the paper that's recycled in Minnesota. It's been in place in that location for almost 100 years, since 1908, employs nearly 500 people in very good-paying jobs. Most of them are represented by, I believe, the Steelworkers Union. It's been a good neighbor in our community, and it's been a really good business for the state of Minnesota. As Mr. Greenshield says, I'll have with me the general manager and Senior Vice President. Sorry, I didn't know the whole entire title. Jack Greenshields from Rock 10 and Lori Lauder from the St. Paul Port Authority. And I'll probably steal your line because you've been saying this for so many years that we've been talking about this, that they are the unintended, or we are here to correct an unintended consequence of what's been really, really good public policy. And that is the MERP, the Metropolitan Emissions Reduction Project, which is something that the legislature had a lot of discussion about in previous years, where Xcel voluntarily, but with some help from some legislation, decided to convert two of their oldest coal plants in their portfolio, one in St. Paul, the High Bridge plant, and one in Minneapolis, to natural gas. And there's also some changes to one other plant. But what they're doing at the High Bridge plant in St. Paul is converting it from coal to natural gas, and that will take place at the groundbreaking's occurred. I think it's going to open sometime this year, that it will start producing electricity with natural gas instead of coal. And this is something that was widely supported and welcomed across St. Paul and the surrounding area as a really wonderful step forward for our air quality in the city. And so it's been a great thing. However, the problem is that the Rock 10 company has relied for many years on the steam produced at that plant. And so they are in the position where they are not going to have an energy source that they need to run their plant after the conversion is complete. And so what we're trying to do is to help them make their way to the next solution, the next energy solution that will keep this plant running. And as I said, they've been a really good neighbor in our community, and they've been committed to building a biomass plant to replace that steam that they're losing from the High Bridge plant. And so there's been a tremendous amount of discussion about this, and there's been a lot of different versions of this bill. And I do have a delete-all amendment that I want to offer as an author's amendment today. So maybe we should pass that out. The A2 amendment is the version I'd like to propose. And there's a lot of different ways we've talked about trying to help them over the last several years. And it's still in discussion with Rock 10, with District Energy of St. Paul, which runs the biomass plant in downtown St. Paul, with the St. Paul Port Authority, which is offering to own the new energy facility and operate it, correct? Mm-hmm. Along with District Energy, and with Xcel. And so there's been a lot of discussion, and I think we're getting very close to figuring out a plan that will work for everyone. And there's also an issue that I have with my constituents and that all of us have with the people in St. Paul, some of whom have some concerns about the fuel source that will be used at the plant. So that's one of the issues that we're continuing to have discussions on and to figure out where to go and how to move this project forward. Because I strongly support the project. I want to see a biomass plant there, and we all want to see this company continue to operate and employ all those people and do the good work that they do. I have a lot of constituents who are concerned about the possibility of burning garbage at the plant, RDF, et cetera. So we have a lot of work to do, and Rock 10 has been working extremely hard with the community and attending countless meetings and trying to reach an agreement with everyone. And I know that everybody who's been involved with this is demonstrating very good faith about moving forward and trying to find a win-win here. And so it's in that spirit that I just want to offer this amendment, and I'll just explain briefly what it would do. It has two pieces. One is to put in place another provision, which will have to go to Senator Rest Committee, and we apologize for adding to your workload the last week of committee deadline. But the Port Authority needs this language change. They need this authority to have a not-for-profit corporation to be able to participate in the role that they would like to be able to own and operate this energy facility. There's the next paragraph relates to Xcel's concern to make sure that the energy, if they had excess electricity, that they would sell that or energy. Well, we have to kind of debate that point, but whether Xcel would like that to be sold back to them rather than to have them retail wheel. And so that's an issue that we've been discussing. And then finally, I have many, many constituents who I've worked with who want to ensure that there will be local involvement and input, and that the local community groups that are very active in the discussions about this will have an opportunity to weigh in on the where the plant ends up going. And so this is an effort to try to capture that sentiment that we want to have support from local community organizations as this project moves forward. So that's the gist of it. I would just point out that in the House, and since we're in committee, I'll talk about the House. I won't do that on the Senate floor, per se. But in the House, this is in the omnibus finance bill, the energy finance bill, and they have some general fund dollars set aside that Rock 10 has requested to help pay for the initial costs of engineering and the EIS. And as we go to the conference committee, we hope that we can work out something that's agreeable, that we can all help move this forward. So I don't know where that's going to end up, but it was important to be in front of the policy committee to have a discussion about this. So this is an author's amendment, so I guess I'd like to just move the amendment and then take some testimony, if I could.
Okay, Senator Anderson moves the A2 amendment. Any discussion? And all those in favor, please signify by stating aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Amendment is adopted. Senator Rest.
Do you want to say anything? I don't think we've added everything. Oh, okay. Anything you want to add?
I would if I could.
Sure.
Great. Madam Chair, good afternoon, and good afternoon, committee members. My name is Lori Lauder. I'm the Director of Industrial Development for the St. Paul Port Authority. And Senator Anderson has explained quite well the reason why we have this issue with Rock 10. I'd like to emphasize the economic loss this would be to Minnesota if we lose Rock 10. As probably all of you know, the Port Authority is an economic development agency whose mission is to promote business growth and jobs for area residents. Unfortunately, Rock 10 is controlled by its corporate headquarters in Norcross, Georgia. We lost several years ago over 300 jobs as the company closed the carton folding plant. And I think Mr. Greenshields here as the plant manager and senior VP has done yeoman's work as far as keeping the plant open to this point in time. We have 500 other jobs there. Let me tell you a little bit about them, a couple of statistics here. This company here that's located at Vandalia and 94 in the midway of St. Paul spends over $75 million in the state of Minnesota per year on goods and services. The other thing is that this company has a payroll of over $25 million. Most of these jobs, and I think a vast majority of them are union jobs, pay around $60,000 per year. The company has been, I think, for many years now, the largest paper recycler in the state of Minnesota. So this is not just a St. Paul company. It really is a state of Minnesota company. And as an aside, they recycle fully 1% of the paper products in the United States. So it is a huge economic force on about 42 acres in the Midway. With that having been said, I'd be happy to take any further questions, but as you note, as Senator Anderson mentioned in your bill draft, the Port Authority is asking for your approval in establishing another nonprofit affiliate of the Port Authority, and that really has a lot of reasons to it. And just simply put, it's very similar to the private sector. When there are large projects undertaken, you probably know the private sector will establish a limited liability corporation. So this is very similar to that. And it will allow us to separate all the accounting functions. It will protect the port's general assets as we move forward with this. It will allow tax credits for investors because we would need this entity in order to do that if we were able as part of the financing to provide tax credits for investors. And certainly for equity partners, they would need this entity as well. So I know you want to wrap it up, Madam Chair. Thank you so much for your time.
Madam Chair, I just want to also make a point. The plant, Rock 10 and the previous, it was previously Waldorf and Champion, maybe some of you remember those days, invested over $60 million in this steam delivery system from the Highbridge to the plant. And that was used for 22 years. It was made in anticipation of being part of the XL system for 50 years. Now, a lot of it's been depreciated, but there's basically $19 million of investment, which they will never recoup. And so You know, our original bill asked for recovery as part of the MERP recovery, cost recovery, but that was a difficult, contentious proposal. And so what we've done is tried to find some other ways of trying to support them, and so I'm really hopeful that we can, as I said, that we can continue to work on these discussions and find a winning solution that works for everyone.
Okay. Mr. Greenshields, did you want to say anything?
I'd be happy to answer any questions, Madam Chair, but I think both of my colleagues have pretty much laid the situation out very well. Just one final note, if I may. We just concluded with the Green Institute of Minneapolis, with a number of other people that participated in it, a very large detailed study regarding biomass availability within the state of Minnesota. That's on our website, and it's cross-referenced to the Green Institute website. It is public information, and we'd encourage anyone that's interested in renewable resources and biomass to certainly look into that greatly. We have an upcoming appointment with the head of the Department of Natural Resources, who's very interested in that study and biomass with us, and we'll be doing that within the next couple of weeks. This is really a chicken and egg type of thing when we talk about renewable resources. Without a power plant that can use flexible fuels and have multiple streams of different types of renewable fuels, you'll sometimes not develop the infrastructure that'll be necessary to get those fuels to the marketplace. And we hope this will be a demonstration project so that you can start doing that and develop renewable fuels in a very meaningful way in the state of Minnesota.
Madam Chair, I just want to add to that, because I'm really glad that you said that, because I should have talked about that as well, and that's really an important point that Mr. Greenshields makes. You know, in the legislature, we've talked a lot about the next generation of biomass and trying to use prairie biofuels or native grasses, perennial grasses for biofuel, and we've heard all the research about how good that is and what potential it has for an energy source. But as Mr. Greenshields said, this report, it's clear that it's not ready to go right now. And so what we're looking at, when we look at fuel choices, right now we're relying on coal for that plant. And soon the interim that they'll have to be using is fuel oil. And so I'm hoping that eventually we can get to a point with this plant, hopefully sooner than later, where it would be reliant on crop production biomass. That would be really a wonderful environmental solution, I think would be broadly supported across our city. So we just have to make those steps to get there, and I think that we will do so with your support.
Okay. I also have listed as a speaker, Shar Knutson.
Yes, I'm so sorry. I forgot she was here. Where is she? She's not here?
Okay.
Madam Chair. Okay. Well.
Senator Rest.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First of all, I guess a question for Council. 465.717, is that the statute that speaks to local governments being able to establish not-for-profit corporations?
Mr. Fuller?
Yes. It says unless
specifically
authorized. So, Senator Rest.
Senator Anderson, it looks like that you're asking for it, and I'm trying to get the positives and the negatives there, an exception to the statute rather than saying in accordance with the statute there will be this special law. And I hope that before you come to the state and local government committee that you put a little bit more specificity about what kinds of activities, how the transparency of this corporation is going to be dealt with in this not-for-profit corporation. It seems to me that it's just wide open at this point, and I'm a little bit nervous about that, even though I think it's a good idea. And then secondly, receiving support from local community organizations, I wonder how do you envision that support coming, and how will anyone know whether it's been received? Because you talk about the facility receiving the support, but shouldn't the support from the local community organizations be presented either to
the board of the not-for-profit corporation or the St. Paul Port Authority, and should there be a even within this bill, an opportunity for public expression at some sort of public hearing process so that local organizations could do that. That seems to me to be fairly general as well, and I hope that you maybe could tighten that up somewhat so that these local community organizations would feel a little bit of comfort about exactly who they have to express their support to, what does it mean if they don't like it, and can the facility proceed if 5 out of 6 say yes and 1 says no? It seems to me there needs to be a little bit of further work on the language of with regard to what I think is a fairly good idea about how the Port Authority shouldn't be the ones doing this, but this is looks like a good purpose for allowing a local government to set up a not-for-profit organization, which we are very, very careful about not allowing in most instances.
Senator Anderson, or?
Well, on the issue of the local community organizations, you're absolutely right. This language is, it's a starting point. And, you know, we have, in St. Paul, we have the district council structure, which yes. is quite well established by city charter or city ordinance. And those organizations are very actively involved in studying this issue, participating in meetings, and expressing their opinions. And so we want a way for them to have a role in this, but we haven't quite figured out the right way to do it. And so I'm hoping that we can come up with, this is sort of a, as I said, a first step at trying to establish that principle in place without creating the city's very concerned about creating too big of barriers.
So Madam Chair, Senator Anderson, you
Senator
might
Rest.
Consider expanding this to indicate that, you know, community support from community organizations can be reflected in resolutions adopted by these district councils. And that way it doesn't need to be, you know, 5 out of 6 or whatever. And then I have a further question. You mentioned that there, this issue is present in the House Energy Finance.
It is,
bill,
but not this
and
language.
Is it, it not in this, not this language. What's reflected in that bill is in your original bill.
No,
Senator Anderson.
Madam Chair,
I mean, I'm just
Senator
curious.
Rest,
I mean,
it's different
this
language.
Because this is a major departure, Madam Chair,
I know.
From Senator Anderson's
process.
Original bill.
No, what's yeah? Thank you. The House language is essentially a grant to
okay.
the St. Paul Port Authority for the environmental review and permitting, preliminary engineering, and development of the facility, with some criteria related to the grant. Because we didn't have that proposal in time to put it in the omnibus bill, we're not proposing it as a fiscal issue at this point. But
so
when we go to conference, that will certainly be something we can negotiate with the House.
So, Madam Chair,
Senator Rest.
I would then want to know from Ms. Lauder, do you prefer getting some money and doing it yourself, or do you prefer the ability to set up a not-for-profit corporation to take on this responsibility?
Ms. Lauder.
Madam Chair and Senator Rest, we really need both. We need the money initially to do the work, the important engineering work, to get our arms around what this energy center will look like. That's very fundamental. And then as we move forward on the construction and financing and management of the facility, we need the new corporation, which, by the way, we would be happy to comply with any and all reporting requirements. I don't have 465.717 in front of me, but if that's what it says and your language about in accordance with, we would be happy to do that.
Finished?
Yep, I'm finished.
Senator Carlson.
Yep, Madam Chair and Senator Anderson, can you give me some of the background thinking of lines 1.8, 1.9, the prohibition of selling energy to anyone else. The district heating plant in St. Paul is one of the most successful energy episodes that's ever happened to this city, and I'm wondering why we would specifically bar any kind of sharing of this kind of efficiency.
Well,
Senator Anderson.
Madam Chair, Senator Carlson, I think it would be an incredibly great opportunity to have to have a biomass plant if there was excess electricity to sell it to power the light rail line going through or to send it to excess steam to the University of Minnesota campus. But this is at the request of Xcel to put this language in here because they are concerned about, you know, competing utilities, so to speak. And so I think we do need to have some more conversation about what that means. You know, what would it look like if they were allowed to have some flexibility to sell some of that power? But they had asked for this language to be included. So that's why it's there. Senator Carlson.
Thank you.
Any further questions? Senator Olstein.
Madam Chair, I'm sure Rock 10 visited with all the other senators, but my recollection was that the request was for something to do for the $20 million left in the in the pipeline investment, and then that they would build this themselves. So what is how has that changed from that time? I'm kind of interested.
Madam Chair, Senator Olstein,
Anderson.
You're absolutely correct. That was our original proposal, was to recover the cost from Xcel as part of the overall cost of the MERP project. And, I mean, honestly, that was really the utility was very uncomfortable with that. And so there's been a lot of negotiations with Xcel since that time. And so we're trying to come to an agreement about how they can assist with the project without going down that road in policy. And so we're hoping that we can get some support from them to help build the project. But there will be also some need for public support, probably, to get this done.
If I may. So then I've heard a number of concerns with the bill, and I know we have timelines and stuff like that. So is this something that if we pass it out as this, the concerns you've heard and that would be addressed before it would
Senator
move on?
Anderson.
Madam Chair, it's really important for me to state that this is a work in progress. And, I mean, this committee's, needs to have oversight and input on this. And but it's something that will be discussed further in the conference committee because the House has a very different approach than what we're doing. And so we're going to have to try to negotiate something between us, the Senate and the House. And we just wanted to establish a Senate position that was reasonable. But I am, and all the other folks involved in this, I know are completely committed to trying to work out an agreement that everybody likes and supports before the end of this legislative session. And that's what we intend to do. So you have my commitment on that.
Okay. Other questions? Senator Senjum.
I know it's a little early, in Madam Chair and Senator Anderson, I know it's a little early in all of this contemplation to have many answers, but one of the questions I guess I would have is can you think this can economically work based on the sale of energy and the sale of steam to pay back this kind of an investment, even if there is some state money? This seems to be a fairly major investment. I would believe well beyond $20 million or whatever that number is. Are there any thoughts on that?
Sure. Ms. Lauder.
Madam Chair and Senator Senjum, yes, there have been thoughts. This is a large facility, biomass. It will avoid fossil fuels, as you know. And the numbers that we're still tweaking are somewhere in the order of a couple of $100 million. We believe that about $160 million can be derived from investors who would purchase the bonds that we will issue. There's a $40 million gap, and we know that we need to work hard to fill that. maybe with some federal sources. The $4 million that we referenced in the House is the first $4 million out of the 30 or 40 or so to really get us around the engineering pieces of it. And so, yes, there is an emerging financing plan, and it's certainly complicated, but it's not the first time something of this nature has been done.
Okay. Thank you.
Other questions? Is there anybody in the audience that wishes to address the committee? Okay. Senator Anderson.
All right, Madam Chair, I would move that Senate File 2041, as amended, be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on State and Local Government. Is that the correct name?
Yes. Any questions or comments? And on Senator Anderson's motion, all those in favor, please signify by stating aye.
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 Opposed? The motion passes. Senator Anderson, you have one more bill.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Good job. Yes, thanks. Thank you very much. Hey, Bill, come on up. I don't think so.
Yeah.
Oh, you do? Okay.
Something of that nature.
Okay. When I said this to Rick, he kind of laughed and said, no, we don't, we're not intending non-nuclear infrastructure, nuclear. So yeah. I just want to say that because some people have raised that as an issue. That should be clear. Yeah. That wouldn't be really fit very well. Sorry, Madam Chair, I got to find all my different notes. Three bills in a row. Okay. Madam Chair and members, Senate File 2199 is some language that appears in the Environment, Energy, and Natural Resources Finance Omnibus Bill, and it was important for this committee to have an opportunity to review this language. And so we're here today for that purpose. And essentially what we're doing is a couple of things. Under the 1994 law related to Prairie Island nuclear waste storage, that's a long and complicated history of what happened with that bill and that plant. But one piece of it that has been ongoing state policy has been that Xcel has paid an amount to the Renewable Development Fund. They created the Renewable Development Fund as a result of the 1994 legislation and agreed to pay into that a certain amount for each cask containing spent nuclear fuel that was stored at the Prairie Island plant. This bill would continue that policy, but for the Monticello plant. And just for a quick summary, in 2003, the legislature changed the law so that there's legislative approval of the spent fuel storage is no longer required for the Monticello plant. But there is a year time period in which the legislature has the authority to act to approve or disapprove that decision. And so if casks are stored at Monticello, ultimately, then this fee would apply to those casks. And this language that you see in front of you is the result of negotiations that I've had with Xcel about that issue. And they proposed as a compromise the language that you see in this bill, which is a smaller amount of dollars per cask than what was put in the Prairie Island bill because it's a much smaller plant and smaller casks. And also, Xcel has asked in this compromise language to be able to receive cost recovery for their greenhouse gas reduction improvements that they make. And there's one small amendment that I'd like to make that I think is something that we all agreed was we meant, but we didn't say it, and I that would be on page 2, line 14. After the word commission, insert the word non-nuclear. And this was not intended to be a mechanism for recovering costs for nuclear plant upgrades or improvements. So,
I'm sorry, you said it should say
non-nuclear. So that the cost recovery would apply to projects to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, but not specifically to nuclear projects, which wouldn't be consistent with the spirit of this.
So I'm not sure
language.
If you're saying nuclear and non-nuclear or if you're just saying non-nuclear.
Non-nuclear.
So before nuclear, add non-hyphen.
No, before electric. Before electric.
Okay.
After commission and before electric, non-nuclear electric and natural gas infrastructure improvements. So that's what it should have said that originally, and that was just something we neglected to clarify. So I would move that as an author's amendment because I think that reflects the agreement that we had originally.
Senator Anderson, you have an A1 amendment also?
Do I?
Yeah, I think it was language that was overlooked.
Oh, yes. I think this is some technical changes suggested by Mr. Fuller. Is
well, they're
right?
pretty big.
Well, where did they come from? Are they
really?
From you?
Okay.
No one told me where they came from. Someone handed me
this.
I
guess they're technical, but they do reflect the intent.
Mr. Fuller, I think, did these on his own suggestions, so maybe he can explain why they're needed.
Well, Madam Chair,
I don't have it.
Yeah. It's just that there's a conflict within the bill as it now stands. You'll notice on page 1, line 10, it talks about $7,500,000 each year. And anyway, there's a conflict. The bill intended to have the $5,250,000 payment for each year the plant was not in operation, and the commission found there was not a good faith effort to remove the spent fuel rods from the facility. And in one place it says $7,500,000. And so that just makes it consistent that it's the number that was agreed to was $5,250,000 and not the $7,500,000. So it is a technical amendment.
Well, Madam Chair, I guess then I would incorporate that into my oral amendment and move those as an author's amendment to get the bill in the proper shape.
So Senator Anderson offers the A1 amendment along with the oral amendment as an author's amendment. Any questions? All those in favor, then please signify by stating aye.
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 Opposed? That motion is adopted.
And then, Madam Chair, I'd like to have some brief testimony from my witnesses, please. First, who wants to go first?
I can go first.
Okay. I'll let you introduce yourself if you don't mind.
Madam Chair, my name is Jim Alders. I'm with Xcel Energy, Manager of Regulatory Projects. I've been involved in the process of obtaining a certificate of need from the Public Utility Commission for spent fuel storage at the Monticello plant over the last 2 years. The Commission spent a great deal of time looking at that question and concluded that indeed the plant should continue to operate because it provides our customers very economical power and it can do so safely. And if you don't continue to operate that plant, there will be significant additional air emissions from fossil fuel plants that would result. As Senator Anderson presented to you, we've been working with her to try and develop some kind of compromise along the lines that she outlined. When I testified at the Finance Committee, the theme or thrust of my testimony was that Xcel Energy thinks that we're in a new environment today, a new paradigm, that it's no longer investments in renewables in exchange for operating a nuclear power plant, that instead in part as the result of the aggressive renewable energy standard that the legislature has set. It's now a matter of finding ways to reduce the carbon impact of our power supply, and that is through a combination of resources like nuclear power and aggressive commitments to renewables. And it's no longer just Xcel Energy. But nonetheless, we worked with the senator to come up with an approach that hopefully does put that paradigm of operating nuclear power in exchange for commitments to renewables further behind us. And we agree with the amendment that the senator has proposed.
Thank you. Mr. Grant.
Chair, and members, Bill Grant for the Isaac Walton League. I am a member of the Xcel Energy Renewable Development Fund Board. Just a real quick history. Senator Anderson alluded to some of this in the 1994 legislation that required $500,000 per CASP per year be placed into a fund. The fund actually didn't get started until additional legislation was passed in 1999, and at that point the RDF board was created, consisting of two representatives from the environmental community and two from Northern States Power, which now, of course, Xcel Energy. Since then, we have added representation from the Prairie Island Indian community, from the large business class, and also from smaller and residential customers. The 2003 legislation changed the amount that was going into the fund per year from the Prairie Island casks from the $500,000 a year to a flat $16 million per year. And then in 06, of course, we had the approval of cask storage at Monticello, but the fund legislation or language was not updated at that time. Of course, the rationale is that we need to find an alternative to nuclear power as long as we've got waste storage going on in the state. I agree with Mr. Alders that the paradigm is changing and that the focus really is on finding ways to limit carbon emissions from the power sector, and we believe that this accomplishes that task as well. The Renewable Development Fund funding focuses on those projects that are in near commercial status so that we can get those projects fully commercialized and to market. And this is a gap in current funding. There's a fair amount of original research going on with respect to new renewable energy technologies. And then, of course, once projects are fully commercial, they're finding their way into the marketplace through contracts with utility companies and others. What really is missing is the kind of funding that the RDF fund provides, and that is that gap between R&D and full commercialization. The handout that I passed around gives you a summary of the breakdown of how those funds have been used and also the projects that have been funded in their location. One thing that's important to point out about that is that that only covers the funding that the RDF board has actually had discretion to spend. The legislature, since 2003, has used funds in the fund for other purposes. And in fact, while the RDF board has committed funding for $42.5 million, there have been withdrawals from the fund totaling $44 million. So we're actually spending less than half of the money that would otherwise be going into these projects. I believe that the bill that in front of you continues policy wisely adopted in 94. That Minnesota research and develop alternatives to electric generation that results in radioactive waste storage in the state, but that also really helps reduce our carbon emissions. It places $350,000 per CASP per year into the RDF to continue and expand the fund's good work. Funds are capped by the total CASPs at Monticello, and it would be further capped if the plant ceases operation, but the casks remain at Prairie Island. So I think this is a good extension of existing policy, and we would urge your support.
Senator Koch.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Anderson, currently, and maybe Mr. Grant can help us answer this too, what is the cost to individual ratepayers and estimated cost of the existing renewable development fund per ratepayer?
Mr. Alders.
Madam Chair, Senator, it's $16 million a year divided by over a million customers. It's a very small number. I don't know.
So estimate maybe $16 per customer, 19?
It would be much less. I would guess it would be on the order of less than $5 a year.
$5 for annually?
Annually. That's a pure guess.
Okay.
I'll get that number for you.
And Senator, Madam Chair, Senator Anderson, any estimates on the cost per ratepayer of the renewable energy standard that we just put in place? I know we heard about the wind integration study, that the integration may cost a relatively small figure to ratepayers, but do you have any estimate on what the energy standard is going to cost per ratepayer, the new renewable energy standard we just put in place?
Madam Chair,
Senator Anderson.
Senator Koch, I think that will save ratepayers money. And, in fact, Xcel has stated before that their incorporation of more renewables into their portfolio has saved ratepayers money. Some of the other major utilities have said that as well. So I don't view that. I mean, we don't know exactly what it will be, but there's plenty of reason to believe it will be a cost saver.
But, Madam Chair and Senator Anderson, I believe that the wind integration study indicated that there would be an increased cost to the ratepayers. And I know there is some debate over that, but I think that on the floor we finally sort of decided we don't know. We don't know for certain.
Madam Chair,
Senator
Koch, the wind integration study talked about how much it costs to account for the intermittency of wind. So you factor that into the price, but that doesn't mean that that's on top of the price that you'd pay for a fossil fuel plant. It's compared to a fossil fuel plant. So it's actually still, even accounting for the wind integration costs, I think there's evidence that we've had testimony about will still come in lower than, for example, a new coal plant. So it doesn't mean that it will cost more. It just means that that's part of the cost, but it's still a lower cost. But you're right, we don't know exactly.
Madam Chair, Senator Anderson, this is my concern, and I think I voiced it on the floor, Senator Anderson. We've done a tremendous amount with renewable energies this year. We've done Xcel has had the Rural Renewable Development Fund for years and years and years, since 94. So my concern is that in addition to the renewable energy standard, which we do not know where that's going to go for consumers, we know that this renewable development fund is already costing Xcel ratepayers additional dollars. You said that any increases in rates hit disproportionately hard to low and moderate incomes, as well as businesses, who then pass their costs on to the consumers. I guess I just sort of view this charge as additional overcharge. They're already paying $16 million a year to store their nuclear waste. I think that it's an interesting discussion we had about the paradigm shift. I think that the paradigm has shifted in this state. 94, there wasn't a lot of renewable energy development going on. So this was important to the mix. This was sort of a way to jumpstart it. Now we've passed this landmark legislation, and renewable energy is going to be developed and invested in greatly in the state, and that's why we passed that legislation. In my way of thinking, I just see this as sort of additional overcharge to the ratepayers, well-intentioned, but it is going to cost ratepayers more. And I think that we have made great strides this year in renewable energy, and I just don't think that this additional charge is necessary.
Madam Chair and Senator Koch, I can't argue with you that we have to be very conscientious when we talk about charges to ratepayers. I think that's critically important. And that was an issue that came up in the Rock 10 discussion, for example, that we decided that was not the way to go, to lay that on ratepayers. However, I think part of the paradigm shift that we're having is to realize that the cost of conventional fossil fuels and nuclear power perhaps have more long-term costs to our constituents and to ratepayers than renewables, and that this is a really small price to pay to help them make that transition to an energy system that will actually be not only healthier and better for our environment, but actually be better for economically for all of us, because there's so many hidden costs with those with fossil fuels, for example, that we're not incorporating in the costs that we pay. And so I think that's part of the paradigm shift that we're in the middle of and we haven't completed. So you make valid points.
Any other questions?
Madam Chair?
Yes, Senator Dahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Grant, I'm looking at some of the projects that you've got here, and I'm just wondering, you were talking about emerging technologies, and like, I know that technology is really what we're going to need, some sort of breakthrough if we're going to address these issues and challenges we have ahead. Is there anything that is getting very close? I mean, in some of the funding of the projects that you've been working with, that we could say it's either going to reduce carbon emissions on our coal-fired plants or get us to a place where we can avoid having to, deal with the nuclear waste, the way of using that nuclear waste in other positive ways possibly. Can you point to anything that those dollars are finding some success?
Mr. Grant.
Madam Chair and Senator Dahl, actually there are a number of projects throughout here. I would point, for example, to some of the renewable ethanol projects that are really looking at some of the opportunities that we think we have for the development of cellulosic ethanol as examples. I'll also point to some of the solar research projects, which we believe are a little bit further away from being fully commercial, but that huge strides are being made in cost reductions associated with certain materials that are being used in advanced solar collectors. One of the projects that I'm most interested in is not really a renewable development or a renewable energy project per se, but one that provides ancillary support to renewable energy projects, and that's the very last one on the list, the one developed by WinLogix, mm-hmm. which is actually bringing the advanced weather forecasting to utility control rooms so that we have a much better sense of real-time planning for day-ahead expectations for how much wind energy will be available to the utility on that basis. And that project is going into the Excel control room now. So there's a wide diversity of projects, all of which I think advance the ball in the manner that you suggest.
Madam Chair,
Senator Dahl.
I guess, but in terms of reduction on, we're talking about renewable energies. We're moving into that because we're concerned about the carbon emissions. Is there anything in the technology or projects you're doing that are dealing with that issue at all, as far as reducing carbon emissions in, say, coal-fired plants?
Well, Mr. Grant.
Well, I was just going to say, Madam Chair, the ethanol plant, I think, is such a good example because most of our ethanol plants are run with fossil fuels as their power source, either natural gas or even some coal-generated ethanol plants. And what they're doing is trying to figure out how to use some of that corn material or some of that biomass material that you make the ethanol from to run the plant. Because right now, one of the downsides to ethanol is that it actually does use a lot of fossil fuels to create it. And so this is a way to try to minimize the fossil fuel inputs and reduce the carbon outputs from ethanol production. So that is one good example of that. I'm not as familiar
Senator
with all the
May
other
I?
Ones. Pardon me?
May I?
Yes, please.
Mr. Alder.
Madam Chair. Senator, the Renewable Development Fund is commissioned to take a look at ways to enhance renewables.
Okay.
And so the direct answer to your question is no, there isn't research from this fund going on to reduce emissions at coal plants directly, but by increasing renewables, we decrease the operation of other fossil fuel power plants.
And Madam Chair and Senator Dahl, again, if you look at the last page, the University of North Dakota project is studying the actual co-firing of biomass in coal-fired power plants,
right.
Which to the extent that that transition is being made or that substitution is being made, you are directly reducing carbon emissions from those facilities.
Thank you.
Senator Jungbar.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Anderson, I guess I'm a little troubled with this new tax on nuclear waste. It just I had been out to a Department of Energy briefing in Chicago a few weeks back where the Department of Energy is telling us that, you know, Yucca Mountain, where we were supposed to store this stuff, got shut down by the environmentalists long enough where now the citizens are in an uproar about it, and we keep on putting that out further and further and further, so we don't have a place to store it. And I'm wondering, rather than tax the storage, why we don't work more with secondary generation on using that spent fuel, like France. I mean, they're actually closer on secondary generation than we are on cellulosic ethanol. Why can't we reuse that? I mean, President Carter shut down reprocessing, but secondary generation reusing the spent fuel doesn't require reprocessing.
Madam Senator Chair, Anderson. Senator Jungbauer, I guess the first thing I would say is I think that this committee, I'm hopeful that this committee will have a full-blown discussion on the pros and cons of nuclear waste storage and the future of our nuclear plants. I think that's an appropriate issue for us to explore in more detail. And that would include, but I don't know that we're going to do that today, but I think that that would include a discussion about the prospects for moving the waste to Yucca Mountain or any other national repository. I mean, we debated that at length for many, 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 many hours in 1994 and in subsequent years, and it was clear in 1994 that, well, it's not the solution still isn't there. And I hear that Senator Reid, who obviously is from Nevada and is in a powerful position now, is considering opening a search for alternative sites now. And so who knows what's ever going to happen. It may or may not open. And I know that, not for lack of trying by Xcel, and they have sunk a lot of ratepayer money into trying to pay for a site for nuclear waste storage, which is one of the costs that we pay. Anyway, so that's such a long, complicated issue. But you know, we know that we haven't done reprocessing for very good reasons in this country because of fears of proliferation, which I think remain at least as strong now as they have been in past years with the threat of terrorism and rogue nations, et cetera. So I think there's obviously there is a debate that's probably being rekindled around the country now about the future of nuclear power, and that's something we ought to engage in that discussion.
Senator Jungbauer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Anderson, it just seems like that discussion is so appropriate as we're talking about greenhouse gases, and we're dealing with the only kind of energy that produces no CO2, and yet we're the only state that's outlawed it. We're not looking at how do we open up this discussion. It seems disingenuous to not bring the nuclear to the table as we're talking about all this. If we really are serious about greenhouse gases, we really seriously need to look at nuclear again.
Madam Chair and Senator Jungbauer, you know, if we solve the nuclear waste disposal issue, I might start to agree with you. But right now we have a tremendous problem, and we have no solution in sight. And it's very likely that we will have that waste to dispose of in our state for years and years and possibly generations to come. And so it's a complicated, it's not a simple question, but
Senator,
I hear what you're saying.
Well, Madam Chair and Senator Anderson, that was exactly the point I made to begin with, is that France is using secondary generation with spent fuel, and yet we're taxing the nuclear storage rather than figure out a new way to use it. We're going to use it as a tax base to come up with something else, which doesn't solve the problem when we, in fact, might take that same money and solve the problem.
And, Madam Chair, I guess the other thing I would say is this is continuing policy that the state's had in place for many years.
Any other questions? My question is why we should do Section 2. I do have issues with the cost recovery part of it, and I'm wondering why, when I think I'm right when I say that you have cost recovery on transmission projects, on renewable projects, on SIP projects. So what else is this going to give you cost recovery on?
Madam Chair, as we looked at the whole calculus of a compromise, we identified some projects that are of lesser magnitude that would further reduce the amount of greenhouse gas emission impact on our system. For example, Currently, we have transformers, electrical transformers in the system that have a hexafluorocarbon gas, and I don't remember the rest of the chemistry of the darn stuff, but it leaks out of those transformers over time, and that gas can be replaced with a newer gas that has less impact. Those kinds of changes have, I don't know the exact amount, something on the order of a few million dollars of cost. Another example, the gas system in St. Paul has some major trunk lines that are the old cast iron pipe. And over time, we plan to replace that, but we can reduce the normal leakage of gas from those old cast iron pipes by accelerating that effort, and that has an impact of maybe $2 to $3
million. And do those not qualify already for some type of SIP project?
They do not.
Project?
I'm told they do not, and that was what we tried to capture, was those kinds of miscellaneous things. And quite frankly, I'm sure there's probably others that we haven't thought of that perhaps might fit into that same kind of category going forward.
And why is it that Xcel should have this benefit when other utilities don't?
I'm sure if you wanted to broaden the language to cover all utilities, there wouldn't be any objection from us. But
actually, my question is why we should just pass these on to the ratepayers without the PUC having a review of it first.
Well, that's an important element of all of this. Indeed, any of these riders or cost recovery mechanisms require review by the Public Utility Commission. None of these riders can be, or surcharges can be, passed to customers without their approval.
The problem that I really have the problem of the pass-through to the ratepayer. And right now the ratepayer is getting passed through on several avenues. And you are a monopoly. And it seems to me that there needs to be some review of that by some oversight body that would make a decision about whether it's appropriate to pass that type of a rate increase through to the ratepayers.
Madam Chair, all I can do is assure you that all of the riders are set up in a way that before they can be passed on to ratepayers, the Public Utility Commission reviews the proposal and has to approve it first. These are all charges that would be subject to a rate case proceeding, but if they were to go through a rate case proceeding, there would be a mismatch in time between when the investment is made and when we could put them in a rate case and recover them. And so all these riders are trying to do is match up more closely the expenditure to the recovery. And in either case, the Public Utility Commission has to approve and find these proposals suitable for cost recovery.
So, Madam Chair, I think
you're
raising very good points. I just so I'm looking at the language carefully, and it says that the commission may approve proposals if, after notice and comment, they find it's consistent with the public interest, appropriately reduces greenhouse gases from their
generation
without excessive cost.
But it also says the commission shall provide timely recovery of the utility's
right.
costs.
Well, Madam Chair, that's if they approve it. So the approval part is a may. So if they don't approve it, then they don't get timely recovery. They don't get recovery. So the may part, I think, comes first. So I think that helps.
Is anybody here from the PUC that could respond to this?
Yeah,
Well, Madam Chair.
You know, I spoke to somebody from Xcel, and they said that they that it had been a long time since they'd been had a rate recovery case, but they had one within the last couple of years, I believe, and they anticipated that they would be returning every, I think they said, every 2 or 3 years. So if that is the case, why can this not be included in those rate recovery cases?
Madam Chair, it's hard to predict when a rate case is going to be necessary. And so, you know, we're all in the spot of guessing how future rate cases are going to be scheduled. I wouldn't count on 1 or 2 years, every 1 or 2 years myself.
Yeah, Madam Chair.
I said 2 or 3, or it might have been every 3 or 4. But
I think, Madam Chair, they've tended to be pretty far apart. And that, as Senator Senjum mentioned, I don't know the exact.
There are at least two of us that heard every 2 or 3 years from members of Xcel.
So we're good to go.
Madam Chair, I have no doubt that you heard that, but that's an opinion among many at our corporation, I'm sure, too.
Okay.
I think, Madam Chair, that one issue is that they're really expensive.
Yes, I understand.
And so we talked about that before, about the cost of those rate cases. And so
I also understand, though, that there are about 12 situations where rates now are passed through. And I'm wondering how many more we add. And is it going to eliminate the need for rate recovery or for, you know, rate cases? Mr. Fuller, did you have a question?
Mr. Alders, in a rate case, I assume they look at all your entire array of costs. And as time passes, they make some assumptions. And as time passes, some of those assumptions are not accurate. So you may be over-earning or under-earning based on those assumptions. And the concern that was expressed by the PUC was that as you come in seriatim, which each individual one, what's going on with your rest of the company is not before them. So they don't have a firm handle on, in a sense, the totality of your return. And if you are, you know, they're the ones who are supposed to regulate you because there's no market that regulates you. So if there's the absence of the regulation, there is no market, then what happens is serially you come in and they may look good in a serial fashion, but it turns out you may be making too much or too little money. So I think that's the concern that was articulated.
Mr. Alders.
Madam Chair, the Public Utility Commission has the benefit of all sorts of financial reports we make publicly and also directly to the commission. Part of the commission's authority is to review all of that and call us in. If they think things are too far out of whack. And so there are checks and balances regardless of whether we initiate a rate case. And indeed, the commission has authority to address the issues you raise.
They do have that authority, but I mean, why don't we go to that process then of that everything would be just a rate recovery that gets reviewed by the PUC and they decide if you have to go through a rate case? I'm sure it's because it is not as extensive that
Madam
they
Chair,
don't have all of it in front of them.
Madam Chair, you're correct. A rate case is a very expensive and time-consuming proposition. Keep in mind that if we don't have these riders, there is a significant disincentive to invest in all of the things associated with these riders until that next rate case because of the mismatch between the investment and when we can start to recover under that circumstance. And we've simply come to the legislature and to the commission with these rate riders to try and match up investment with recovery with continued oversight from the commission.
And what would be the consequences of waiting until you had the rate case to make those changes?
we'd be reluctant to invest in transmission until that next rate case. We'd be reluctant to invest in all of those sorts of things that rate riders currently cover.
But what I'm saying is that I think, don't you already have pass-through for transmission?
I'm speaking generically to the concept of riders.
Members, I'm going to move to delete Section 2. I don't know if anybody else wants to speak to that.
Well, Madam Chair, my concern Senator is Anderson. That we're trying to reach a compromise here, and so it puts me in a difficult position as in relationship to this effort I've made to compromise with Xcel.
Senator Anderson, I realize that, and I also was part of some of that compromise and was very upfront about saying that I would be challenging this portion of the bill, that I did not agree with it. And actually, they are getting quite a plum on Section 116 to 119. So it's not like they're not receiving some benefit from this also. And that they can use their own renewable development money. Senator Cope.
Madam Chair, and maybe this just kind of goes to my more overall concern. I'd like to have further discussion. I'd like to hear more about the rates. I'd like to have discussion on that. So, you know, I'm inclined somewhat to possibly support your amendment, but I'd like to have more discussion. I think that Senator Jungbauer brought up some good points. I don't think that this can exist without a further discussion of nuclear waste storage. I don't think this bill exists in a vacuum. And I was not here in 1994, and I was not here in 2003. Fully, most of the people sitting around this table were not here in 1994, and it's been 13 years, and things have changed. The scene has changed. And so that's, first of all, why I was very surprised to see a bill that had not been presented to us included an omnibus bill. And I feel a lot of pressure on us today to sort of pass this through, and I don't think there's been a complete discussion on this subject. And so, you know, that is my concern with the whole bill. And I'm not sure if other members share my concern, but I think it bears discussing.
Let me throw this out for the committee. How would you feel about, there has been several requests of me that we deal with some of the nuclear energy bills next week. It's after the deadline, granted, but it is possible to send it to rules, or we can have some discussion and lay it over for next year for further work also. How would you feel about meeting next week to talk about nuclear energy bills?
Madam Chair, as you know, I'm Senator one of the people Anderson. Who's asked you to do that. I think it would be very appropriate to have a discussion on that. So I think it's a good idea.
I'm getting some nods.
Madam Chair, I would welcome that opportunity.
Okay, so next week. We will be meeting next week, okay? But what I would like to do is to remove Section 2, lay it over, and just deal with the first section of the bill at this time, except to Section 1.
Madam Chair.
Senator Rest.
What happens with this bill, whether that's your amendment passes or not? What happens to it next if the bill is moved out of committee?
Actually, Senator Rest, it goes to finance, but it really gives Senator Anderson some direction in the omnibus bill, because this was the language that missed our committee and was adopted in finance. And so I ask that that language come to this committee for review.
Not this exact language.
It was compromised language that we passed on the floor, though.
Madam Chair, Senator Rest, the language that I had in my omnibus bill used current law and added the amount of money per cast from current law for Monticello cast. So that was what's in my bill. And then this represents a proposal that Xcel made as a compromise in reaction to that. And so I guess I would say.
Madam Chair, I'm sorry, I didn't
I didn't see the date on the
right,
on the,
so
the revisor's date, and so I understand now the process.
This
Thank
was
you.
Introduced later. And, Madam Chair, again, I would say, I mean, I'd prefer to keep the language in there because it's part of a discussion that I'm trying to have in the trying to reach a compromise. However, this bill really probably, it's really for the purpose of having some committee discussion and establishing our position. It doesn't have to pass as a separate bill. And so in the conference committee, again, I know the House has a very different approach to this issue. So, again, we're going to this will be, again, a work in progress and an effort to try to find a more compromises in the future. So that's part of what I will be trying to do.
So, Senator Anderson, what is your preference? Would you like us to lay over the whole bill until next week?
I guess, Madam Chair, that's up to you. I, you know, as long as I have an opportunity to move it forward.
What about committee members? What is your preference? Senator Olsey.
Madam Chair, I'd prefer to lay over the whole bill. And if we're going to get into it in more detail, we might as well discuss Section B also at that time.
Okay.
Madam Chair.
Senator Sanjom.
Yeah, I'm okay with laying it over personally. On the other hand, let me just say this. There's a part of this that, again, maybe not unlike my last question, I don't understand. We've talked over the last 3 months about greenhouse gases and carbon dioxide and mercury and maybe particulates along the way and all the sins of coal-fired power plants. And yet we seem to be destined, at least through this bill, to want to impose penalties on what probably is maybe the cleanest and, you know, we can argue about the cast storage, but maybe the safest form of electrical generation we have in Minnesota. And I just have trouble imposing those kind of penalties on things which I view are a generally good way to produce electricity within our state. So I'm torn, but I'm happy to lay it over.
Madam Chair.
Senator Rest.
I move that Senate File 2199 be laid on the table.
Madam Chair.
It's non-debatable.
That's non-debatable. I'm just debating whether I need to withdraw my motion first.
I think it's a higher motion.
Okay. So we all those in favor of laying Senate File, what's an 2199 on the table, please signify by stating aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? So the bill is tabled.
Madam Chair.
Senator Rosen.
Perhaps next week, too, we could have a discussion about the RDF fund. I think there are. I have some questions about the fund and appropriations, and we can expand it a little bit further.
Okay.
I thought the legislation.
Thank you very much. Yes. Thank you.
We have one bill left that we will introduce and discuss, or I guess there will be a delete all amendment.
Do you want to come over here?
We done or what?
We got one more. What do we need to introduce?
Is that already? Is that in the omnibus?
Yeah, this language is in the omnibus.
Oh, okay.
So they're already.
Please out. Yeah, it crosses over with the.
That's not.
Thumbs up to move.
All this right there.
All right, what's the name of this bill?
Oh. Steve, have you passed out the amendment? Why don't you pass out? Okay, and it's over here?
Do we have a bill in here?
We'll wait till people get copies in.
Oh, okay.
So to go to Vegas? Is that what somebody told me?
We were in New York.
Yeah.
Hold on.
Yeah.
Our
clear deal.
to your committee.
Senator Pretnisolin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I apologize that we ran out of copies of the amendment, and I guess somebody is going to be making copies, but I will start describing this as before they're here. And this is a delete-all amendment, the A2 amendment to Senate File 145. And this is obviously not an author's amendment, so I will start describing this.
Did you want to move that amendment?
I can move the amendment, yes. I'll move Senate File or the A2 amendment.
Senator Pretnisolin moves the A2 amendment for Senate File, 145. Did you want to describe that at this time?
I will describe it.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair and committee members, Senate File 145, the Energy Policy Omnibus Bill, is a result of dozens of hours of work by stakeholder groups that met focusing on community-based energy development and global warming. The two pieces that are included in this bill are the two final pieces of a four-prong approach to reducing greenhouse gas emissions and ensuring Minnesota's economy and workforce benefit from energy legislation passed earlier this session. I will remind you that this committee took a major step forward reducing greenhouse gas emissions by passing the Renewable Energy Standard, requiring that 25% of energy be from renewable sources by the year 2025. This important piece of legislation was signed into law in February. The second major component in reducing greenhouse gas emissions was the Energy Efficiency and Conservation Bill that set a 1.5% annual energy savings goal for utility companies. The Senate passed that bill on the floor 2 weeks ago. These two important measures added together have the potential to reduce greenhouse gas emissions in Minnesota by 42% by the year 2025. And I would like to congratulate the committee for your hard work and dedication to making a significant impact on reducing greenhouse gas emissions that contribute to global warming. The third piece to the four-prong approach contained in this bill works to assure community ownership and local benefits with regard to renewable energy development and operation. Article 1 of Senate File 145 amends the current seabed community-based energy development statute. The proposed changes to the statute are the result of a stakeholder group, or a series of stakeholder groups, many, many, many hours of stakeholder groups, actually. And Mike Bull, Assistant Commissioner of Renewable Energy and Advanced Technologies at the Minnesota Department of Commerce, was instrumental in pulling that stakeholder group together and it helped to find common ground on many of the very tough issues. And I have him at the table with me to answer committee members' questions about this provision of the bill and the process it took to get to this language. But let's now walk through Article 1 of the Omnibus Bill, which is a seabed legislation. Under current law, only wind projects can be considered seabed. However, there are many other opportunities for community renewable energy projects, such as solar, methane digesters, and biomass projects. Section 1 allows these projects also to qualify as seabed. Also under current law, distribution cooperatives and distribution municipal utilities are excluded as qualifying owners of seabed projects. Since these distribution utilities are community-owned, they view this section of the seabed statute as problematic. Section 2 allows distribution utilities to be partial owners of seabed projects, thereby further fostering partnerships between utilities and communities on seabed projects. Under current law, seabed projects are subject to a rate cap of 2.7 cents net present value. Originally, the cap was imposed as a cost constraint. No one knew whether seabed projects were going to be competitive with other wind projects in terms of the rate utilities pay these projects for electricity that they generate. It turns out that, in practice, the cost of electricity generated by seabed projects is equal to other wind projects. In addition, the problem we're facing now is that seabed projects, like other types of wind projects, are experiencing rising costs of steel, turbines, concrete, and other costs, and are starting to bump up against this rate cap. Since utilities are not required to do seabed projects and can negotiate for a rate that works for the utility and their ratepayers, Section 3 of Article 1 removes that cap. Current law has a couple of provisions to promote seabed partnerships with utilities and independent power producers. For example, a wind project that includes at least 10% seabed, for example, 10 megawatts of seabed in a 100-megawatt project, is exempt from certificate of need requirements. But no one has yet created such a partnership. Section 5 explicitly authorizes those partnerships in the hopes that doing so will further encourage parties to partner. Section 6 relates to Xcel Energy's ownership of seabed projects. Xcel is the only utility subject to a requirement that it acquire new generation facilities through a competitive bidding process. The utility has argued that utilizing that process for acquiring its renewable generation assets to satisfy its 30% renewable energy standard requirements may hamper its ability to efficiently meet those requirements. This provision exempts Xcel's acquisition of renewable generation assets for the renewable energy standard from that competitive bidding requirement, unless and until the PUC decides otherwise, but that it makes it equal with other utilities. Under current law, counties can only permit wind projects 5 megawatts and under. Larger projects need to be permitted by the Public Utilities Commission. And in this instance, Commerce acts as commission staff on permitting, but the PUC issues the permits. The problem that has occurred is that small seabed projects are aggregating into larger projects, and it's not clear who has jurisdiction. Some counties want to permit these projects, and others don't. To address this issue, a work group of small, large wind developers, Commerce, and counties came up with these sections. Section 7 says that small projects are to be added up when determining their size for jurisdictional purposes. Sections 8 and 9 allow counties that want to permit larger projects to permit projects up to 25 megawatts. Counties that don't want to aren't required to. And it also provides for uniform standards to be applied by either the state or the county in permitting these projects. Section 10 has been worked out between the transmission-owning utilities of CAPEX and the community wind advocates. It provides for a technical study of the opportunities for installation of 1,200 megawatts of relatively small projects between 10 and 40 megawatts in the existing transmission system without large transmission investments. All parties find the study potentially useful, because the RES ramp rates require a large amount of new renewable generation in the next several years before large transmission projects could be constructed. The final section in Article 1 instructs the Legislative Electric Energy Task Force to study whether or not the state should regulate easements, leases, and other agreements to acquire an interest in real property for wind energy development. The study should determine whether the duration should be limited to promote wind energy development. This concludes the seabed portion of the omnibus bill, and I should note that there were other pieces related to seabed that were advocated in the stakeholder group. However, this year I decided to only include necessary changes in language that was agreed upon. Before we move on to Article 2 in this bill, Assistant Commissioner Mike and I will now stand for questions about that are just specific to this Section 1, Article 1, rather. So just about the seabed legislation.
None. Any further discussion on Amendment to A2? Senator Rosen.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Pittner-Solon, do you have, did you work with people to talk about, well, I see in Section 11 it's about easements and regulating that. As far as distance and placement of these wind turbines, is that part of that section then?
It is a study, actually.
It's a study then? Mr. Chair? I do think that's something that probably needs to be addressed, is some regulation as far as placement. I relate this a little bit to the hog industry and the hog confinement setups. And Mr. Bull is shaking his head. And I do know in where I come from, we are seeing a tremendous amount of wind farms going up. And there are some issues about being wind friendly, about your farm, your wind farm, and to your neighbor. And so I do think this is something that we could look into as far as placement of your wind farm on your property so it does not eliminate or is not a, eliminate your neighbor from putting in a turbine close by or that it's abusive or obtrusive towards your neighbor. So I'm just stating a fact there.
Sure. Mr. Chair?
Yeah, I'm going to Mr. Bull would like to respond to this. Commissioner Bull.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Bull. Senator Solomon, the section of the bill I think that does relate to your question has to do with the permitting section, that there about where these facilities can be placed and how the appropriate sort of setbacks from other people's properties and being sensitive to other folks' wind rights. And that is an issue that is being grappled with on a daily basis as more and more turbines are placed. And the counties and the commission staff and the commerce staff are working very closely together on those kinds of issues to make sure that we have that we're applying uniform standards across the state so that we are able to have that sort of uniform and consistent development of wind projects around Minnesota.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Olstein.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, would that be kind of like counties doing zoning where, like for Lakeshore, that they can be more restrictive maybe than state? So they could be more restrictive in a county than the state standard would be the minimum standard, and if it, their decision, they could be more restrictive? Or
Mr. Chair, Senator Olstein, that's exactly right. And also, to the extent that, counties opt in to decide to permit these projects under 25 megawatts. They also have asked for, and the commission has agreed, within the work group, to say that the commission, when citing projects larger than the 25 megawatts, will look at the specific standards of that county for those projects, and we'll work to work with the county to apply. Even though the state may have jurisdiction over the permitting for those larger projects, we'll work with the county and we'll take those more stringent standards into account when permitting that.
Thank you.
I believe Mr. Fuller might have something else to add to this discussion here.
Well, members, it was new to me, so I'm assuming it might be new to you. Section 11 on page 7. Sort of a late arriving issue, and the issue is that apparently there's a concern that large developers are acquiring development rights over many acres of land, thereby locking up that land and being able to exclude others, and then they may not utilize those interests, so the land can't be developed by anybody else, and they choose not to develop. And the two Dakotas have passed laws that limit the term of those property rights. I think the 5 years, if you don't develop it commercially in 5 years, the right is terminated. So what's happening, so this is in here to study, but also independent of this, there's a bill that's going to be heard in judiciary because it's a real property concern and they have the expertise in that. So I think it's going to be heard this week, so we may hear something from them on that issue. But that's what that's about, the keeping open land for development and not tying it up by larger developers who may acquire thousands of acres and then choose not to develop it.
Further discussion?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Rosen.
Mr. Chair, will we have a chance to discuss both portions of this bill on Thursday also?
Correct? I believe so. I believe so, yes.
Okay, thank you. Just
further discussion on the A2 amendment.
Not today.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Senjum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, I'm looking at Section 8 on page 4, and I'm thinking about my own area, which has a good number of townships involved in planning and zoning. And as I'm understanding this, it's the county board's purview, but I can just think of situations where the township may want to exercise some authority in these decisions as well. And maybe it's a discussion for council. I don't know. I guess the question is, could the township play into this at all in any sort of a legal way?
Senator Prettner-Solon?
Okay. Mr. Chair, Senator Senjum, currently counties do play a role in permitting, and this just specifies further what their role is. Townships do not have a role currently, although there's nothing to prevent a county from taking input from the cities or the townships.
Mr. Chair, I think you understand, but at least in our area of the state, a number of townships have assumed planning and zoning authority and feel rather strongly about that. So I don't know if it's going to present issues or not, but we may be probably don't know that today.
So, Mr. Bull, now what you're saying is that townships and municipalities are not going to be excluded from this process, that they can be invited, or if they're already taking, in the zoning program anyway, they'll be included in this process on the county level. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Senator Senjum, under current law, the only entities that have the authority to site and permit these wind projects is the state and the counties.
Okay.
And this would, but I think that's a reasonable question, is where, maybe going forward, how do we incorporate the townships into these kinds of processes?
And Mr. Chair?
Senator Prettner-Solon?
I think that in the past that there are a lot of counties that really don't want to even get involved in it. And I think that the assistant commissioner would like them to for some of these smaller projects because they're time-consuming.
That's true.
And so that's part of why this was spelled out, giving them the opportunity to do the permitting rather than going through commerce.
Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm wondering, Senator Prettner-Solon, does this stop off in Senator Ress's committee? And maybe if it, I'm not advocating that it does, but if it does, maybe that's where some of Senator Senjum's questions can be worked out. Of course, I think we just added to her workload today a little bit. I don't really want to pop this one in her lap. This is a big one.
Yeah, any further discussion?
Senator Mr. Chair, I doubt that it has to go to local government, mostly because it's an opt-in provision. It doesn't require them to do anything. Well, Mr. Chair, I can go on to Article 2 then.
Mr. Okay. Chair, I will leave this.
Thank you, Mr. Bull. Appreciate it.
Article 2, Mr. Chair, is about global climate change. And first of all, I want to be clear that I believe that it is extremely important to reduce greenhouse gas emissions across all sectors of the economy, whether that's industrial, residential, transportation, agriculture, or whatever. And during this past spring break, I was familiarizing myself with vehicle emissions. And if An Inconvenient Truth is a very, very interesting movie. It provides a lot of good, solid background. But if anybody has not seen Who Killed the Electric Car, it now is out also as a new release in video stores, and it's a very, very interesting commentary on the electric car, and that we actually do have the technology to increase miles per gallon that are received by our cars. And also what I learned was that for every gallon of gas that's burned by a vehicle, there are 19 pounds of carbon dioxide that's put into the atmosphere. And it is believed that if we could convert entirely to an electrical system, we wouldn't have to close down any coal plants, actually, that we would have such a significant reduction in the amount of carbon dioxide emissions. So I would like us to spend, you know, in the future, more time also at looking at automotive emissions and transportation emissions. So that being said, I believe it is the state's best interest to fully study and understand where emissions come from, the various options for reducing emissions rate and service reliability impacts, as well as the effects on the economy before legislating major change. Article 2 of the Omnibus Policy Bill sets a statewide greenhouse gas emissions reduction goal of 80% below 2005 levels by 2050 across all sectors that produce emissions. This bill also gives specific direction to a stakeholder process to return to the legislature next February with extensive information on possible ways to reduce emissions across all sectors of the economy. We had an inclusive stakeholder process with this bill language, and many participants feel this is the right direction for us to go this year. I will now walk through the language of the bill and then stand for questions, but I also want to say that of all the four set prongs of our legislation this year, this was perhaps the most contentious, and I don't think anybody wants to get up and say I support this bill. I think that there is some comfort language for people here, but I don't know that it has satisfied anybody, actually. Subdivision 1 sets a statewide greenhouse gas emissions reduction goal of 80% below 2005 levels by 2050 across all sections that produce, or all sectors that produce emissions. The section identifies different types of greenhouse gases and exempts carbon dioxide that is sequestered and not released into the atmosphere. Subdivision 2 requires that the Commissioner of Commerce, in consultation with the Commissioners of the Pollution Control Agency, Department of Natural Resources, Housing Finance Agency, Agriculture, Employment and Economic Development, Transportation, and the Met Council, must submit a climate change action plan to the legislature by February 1st of 2008. Subdivision 3 requires that a stakeholder process be used when developing the climate change action plan. The stakeholder process must be broadly inclusive and be conducted by an independent, nationally recognized expert entity. Subdivision 4 sets the general criteria of what the climate change action plan must include. And criteria of the plan must first include an estimate of previous greenhouse gas emission levels in the state and make projections of what those levels will be in future dates. Second, identify, evaluate, and integrate a broad range of greenhouse gas reduction options for all emission sectors in the state. Third, assess the costs, benefits, and feasibility of implementing the various options. Fourth, recommend an integrated set of reduction options and strategies for implementing the options that will achieve the greenhouse gas emissions reductions goal in Subdivision 1. Subdivision 5 sets specific plan requirements, including interim goals, and determines the feasibility of a state, regional, and federal cap and trade system, including rate impacts for each type of system. Subdivision 6 requires a plan to include recommendations for improvements in the emissions inventory and recommend whether the state should require greenhouse gas emissions reporting from specific sources, and if so, which sources should be required to report. The committee should know that the Center for Climate Strategies, the organization that is facilitating the stakeholder process and producing the study called for in Article 2, is already planning its first meeting for April 20th. And so I think it's important that we have be as specific as possible in giving them the direction of what we want them to study and the information that we want them to bring back to us. So, Mr. Chair and committee members, that is the gist of this omnibus policy bill. We plan to take public testimony on the bill on Thursday, but if you have questions at this time, I would stand for questions. Thank you.
Questions on Article 2 of the amendment? Senator?
May I have a couple of questions. First, would you repeat again, Senator Prettner-Solon, on April 20th, which group will be meeting? Is it the stakeholder?
Yes, it's the I always forget the name. the Center for Climate Strategies, which is the stakeholder group that will be conducting the study.
Senator Sharon?
On Subdivision 6 on page 8, the regional activities, I do think that the strength of this section is, I think it's in this section, where you're talking about trying to formulate a regional plan for dealing with carbon emissions. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering, is the language strong enough here to say that to set a deadline, a date, does it say clearly who is responsible for calling together the interested parties to have that process be completed by a certain time? I think that's a really important part of what will help us become more comfortable with carbon emission issues related to power production. So I'm very supportive of this idea. I just hope that the language is strong enough that we're clear about who's going to initiate that, what the goals and objectives ought to be of that, and a timeline to achieve that objective.
Senator President Solon? Mr. Chair, Senator Sharon, it does say the state must, with other states in the Midwest region, develop and implement a regional approach. It says that the Commissioner of Commerce shall coordinate Minnesota's regional activities under this subdivision and report to the legislative committees in the Senate and the House by February 1st of 2008 and February 1st of 2009 on the progress that's made.
Senator Sharon.
The reason I'm pressing on this is that I think that after this first study occurs, that if there's a recommendation that comes from that, one of the barriers that we might run into in terms of implementing that will be the suggestion that we should wait again until there's a regional solution to this. So to the best possible extent that we can align those actions, I think we will be more successful in not further delaying an action that I think we all agree is necessary to reduce greenhouse difficulties.
Senator? Further discussion. Senator Olsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Pretner Solon, where's the funding for this study coming from?
Senator Pretner Solon.
Here, it's coming right down the hall right now.
For the record, you should state your name.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Edward Garvey, Deputy Commissioner at the Minnesota Department of Commerce for Energy and Telecommunications.
Thank you, Mr. Garvey.
The study that will be conducted, facilitated by the Center for Climate Strategies, is roughly a $400,000 to $500,000 study. The state of Minnesota will contribute about $40,000 to $50,000, or roughly 10% of that. The balance of that funds will be collected by the center from foundations and endowments that fund it, because that's actually its primary and singular job, is to provide these kinds of services to states. And so they are specifically funded from other entities to provide these kinds of things, so that money is not a barrier to their planning facilitations in states.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Olsen.
Thank you. A follow-up, if I may. Mr. Garvey, then, on the other states that are participating, you know, we're not really specific about which other states, but I assume it'd be bordering states. Would they be contributing to this study also?
Mr. Garvey.
Chairman, members of the committee, Senator Olsen. The regional activities issues that are considered or addressed or directed under Subdivision 6 of Article 2 of the Delete All Amendment is separate from the plan that the Delete All Amendment and that would be derived from the Center for Climate Strategies approaches. This is an effort to communicate with not only our neighboring states but states across the country, and it's already underway. I mean, our state is talking to our neighbors and states across to determine inventory and registry like things, those kinds of issues that we're already underway doing. So those are they're separate.
Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, I just, you know, I'm concerned. You know, I feel like, you know, we're responding to, you know, we had this huge stack of objections that were Xeroxed and put in our pile for committee. And, you know, we're going to have a study, and it's going to come back with a bunch of recommendations that are going to ask a lot of people, a lot of well-resourced people, people with a lot of money, who make a lot of money from doing things the way they are, to go to some expense and some effort to do things differently than they do them now, and it's going to be hard and difficult, and you know, there'll be even more reasons than were outlined in all those resolutions not to do them, and I think this, you know, we'll see, you know, a stack three times, four times as high than we saw in our packet today. So I feel like, you know, we can have the study, and it'll be a great study, and we'll learn a lot, and we'll find out a lot of stuff that we need to do, and we'll be back, you know, where we are this year. A whole lot of people objecting in very strong terms, with very strong language, you know, threatening all kinds of terrible things, calamitous things that'll happen to our economy and our way of life and our ability to enjoy and prosper in the state of Minnesota. And so I just worry that just by taking this approach, we know pretty well what the gig is, and you know, we've taken some pretty strong steps in that direction. This, you know, to take some more specific steps would be just kind of a continuation along that same path. And so I just wonder, Chairman Pretner Solon, if we're just delaying the inevitable and just putting off some difficulty that we're going to have to reckon with sooner or later. You know, we keep hearing, let's put it off, let's wait for federal action, and et cetera. But, you know, we never know if federal action is going to occur, and we certainly know that, you know, I've given the speech before, federal action often is precipitated by action at the state level. So, you know, study's fine, but, you know, I just wonder if it's just another delay tactic and we're just going to be confronting the same challenge that we're confronting today.
Mr. Chair.
We're avoiding.
Senator Pretner Solon.
Mr. Chair, Senator Dibble, but this is very specific. This isn't just putting it off. We need to have answers by February 1st of 2008, and it answers the very questions that we don't know today. They need to tell us what the estimates are of greenhouse gas emissions in 1990 and 2005, and then make those projections about how we can meet standards by 2015, 2025, and 2050. So they need to identify, evaluate, and integrate all the resources that are here in the state and tell us how can we achieve that goal? What is it that we have to legislate and implement in order to be able to come on target? They also need to be able to assess the costs and the benefits and the feasibility of implementing each of those options, and then recommend an integrated plan for how we're going to achieve those reductions in greenhouse gas emissions. I think now we don't know. I mean, we have some suggestions, but we don't have a clear plan for how we would do that. I think that this says this is what we need to know in order to move forward. So next year, with that information in hand, we would be able to pass some legislation based on some solid facts.
Well, Mr. Chair.
Senator Dibble.
I think we know a lot more than we think we know. And I think what we'll find out is what we think we're going to find out, that it's going to take some effort. It's going to be expensive. It's going to be politically difficult to do. I mean, I think that's what we're going to find out.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Pretner Solon.
It was very informative when we had the wind integration study. It really did help us to know that we could go forward with the renewable energy standard. And you found people in the room who had been objecting in the past saying, okay, we can do this. It's going to be hard, but we can do it. And they got behind it, and they're willing to move forward. I think we can do the same thing with this study.
Yeah. Mr.
Senator Dibble.
As long as the wind integration study has been brought up, we're also seeing misinformation being propelled coming out of the wind integration study that says that we have to have a particular coal plant established in order to establish the transmission spine, and that seems to have gotten out there without a real good. I mean, I just need to make that statement. You know, that we keep talking about the wind integration study as if though, we can't do wind integration without a specific coal plant that establishes a particular transmission spine that all the other wind projects can hook onto. And so I would caution us to, if we do this study, that we don't allow perceptions and misinformation to be propelled out of that.
Yeah, Mr.
Senator Prettner-Solin.
Senator Dibble, I maybe some people are saying that a specific coal plant has to be developed, but the wind integration study did say that there needed to be 6,000 megawatts of more wind or more baseload energy production. That was real. That is a requirement in order for the plan to be workable. And we don't have a lot of options out there right now.
I think Senator Sharon was.
If I was, I don't think I was, but I'll sure. Go ahead. thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to go back to this regional activities because I really think that's a critical step that we need to be taking. And I'm confused by the two dates. There's two dates, the environmental policy, there are two dates for reports. One is in February 1st of 2008, which does align with the other process. And then there is another reporting date of February 1st, 2009. That's what's confusing to me.
Senator Prettner-Solin.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Senator Sharon, it basically states that they have to report to us annually for the first 2 years on the progress made and recommendations for further action.
So, Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm tempted to save most of my comments for Thursday when we'll be voting after I have a chance to really read this carefully, but I just want to respond briefly because Senator Dibble's comments were absolutely hit the nail on the head, and I do have to comment about that. First of all, the wind integration study was not asked a question about how much baseload we need. So that's not one of the answers that they gave us. That was an assumption that they made, and I think that's a very different thing. And we can argue about that till the cows come home. But I think one of the issues that was suggested by some of the stakeholders is that we should, if we're disagreeing about that, we need some more information. And I don't, if we're going to do a plan, and I'll have a comment about that, but if we're going to just do a plan, if that's all we're going to do this year is a plan, then at the very least, we need to ask those questions and get answers to those questions. We don't have a consensus in this room, let alone in the whole Capitol or outside of the Capitol, about how much energy we need for the state to survive. And I don't believe that this stakeholder group is intended or directed to answer that question. They're intended to say, how would you reduce greenhouse gas emissions in Minnesota? I think that's their charge. And what are the costs and benefits of doing that? And so added to the problem that Senator Dibble has posed, that having yet another plan does not give us political will to take action. You know, I had a bill, I think it was in 2003, that would have, I forget what we called that, the Climate Action Plan or something like that for Minnesota. Mr. Garvey is smiling. At that point in time, unfortunately, the administration wasn't supportive of it, and I really appreciate that they've come a long ways and have been really leaders on this issue, on dealing with. So I'm not trying to be critical by reminding folks that that plan didn't pass because there was a great deal of opposition to even having a plan in 2003. And so I suppose we could say it's progress in 2007 to say that we'll actually pass a plan this year. But it's hard for me to walk outside of this building and tell the people of Minnesota that a planning process to deal with the greatest challenge of our generation is action. And that it means that we will rise to that challenge as a state. It doesn't mean anything of the sort. It doesn't mean that we have grappled with that very difficult question about how are we going to have the guts to make these tough decisions that we have to make to do something about this problem. And that, I mean, I don't know if we can have a stakeholder process that can help us get those, get that political will, but we got to figure out how to do that, because this is not going to get us there, I'm afraid.
Senator Pretner-Solon.
Mr. Chair and Senator Anderson, maybe you know a lot more than I do, and I would say you probably do, but I think there are a lot of new members on this committee that don't know a lot, along with me, and I don't know how to get there, and I don't know whose information to trust at this point. So I feel like we have to develop the charge. We have to ask the questions, and once we have the answers, then maybe we can make a decision. Hopefully, we can make a decision about what we're going to do. But you raised some very interesting things. Maybe that's a question that needs to be added to this. Maybe we need to ask, how much energy do we need in this state to survive?
Well, Madam Chair, I think we certainly do need that information to be answered in a fair and objective way, because I don't think we've gotten very clear answers. But I think that information is available. If we go out and seek it, I think that committee could, our committee could find that information. And perhaps we haven't spent enough time trying to get real answers to that. It's hard to do.
And we are also facing a deadline.
Well, Mr. Chair, I guess I would say that, you know, there's just a huge weight of scientists around the world and policymakers that have figured out that this is a problem that needs quick action if we are going to continue to thrive as a human race. And so it just concerns me that we delay action yet again. And I think that there's a, you know, state after state that has decided that they're ready to take leadership on this. And so why not Minnesota? Why can't we be leaders?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Pretner-Solon.
We haven't been dragging our heels. We have passed very significant legislation this year that already is scheduled to have us reducing our greenhouse gas emissions by 42% by 2025. This bill asks that we wait 10 months, that's all, until we get more solid information about how we put together a solid plan. And I think the other thing is it needs to be an integrated plan. It can't be a piece here and a piece there. It needs to be an integrated plan that takes a look at our state, what its needs are, and then directs us how we can reduce our greenhouse gas emissions.
And I'd have to agree that, you know, we know what the problem is now, but we don't know exactly how to solve that problem yet. I would argue that we should take a little extra time this year to look at those things, take the ideas that we have, all the smart people we have in this room and around the state, and put our heads together to figure out what specifically we should be doing to solve this problem, now that we all agree that it is a problem. I don't think we have those answers quite yet, and it would serve us well to take a little extra time, even though I know the history is that, you know, sometimes certain groups want to, you know, keep pushing back and say we can't do that. Nonetheless, if, you know, the folks around this table, I think for me it's important that we take a little time to figure out what those steps should be first before we implement legislation to do so. So
Mr.
I'm in
Chair,
agreement. Senator Anderson.
One last comment, and I won't go beyond this, but I have a couple of articles I just wanted to pass out just from the last 24 hours in the Pioneer Press and the Star Tribune, and one is an editorial in the Star Tribune. The other one is an op-ed by Christy Todd Whitman, and she, as everyone will remember, was President Bush's first EPA, head of EPA for the country, former Republican governor of New Jersey, and she published an op-ed today that talks about how a cap and trade worked many years ago successfully to reduce sulfur dioxide emissions. And so it seems to me that we have to reinvent the wheel so many times. If we just were able to really look at all of our past experience and the experience around us, I think there's a lot more answers than we think. So I hope members will
we'll look at that.
Now, this discussion will be continued on Thursday, if I'm not mistaken, and I do want to take a few more comments from folks, but we should probably move this amendment so that we can get it in the shape that the author wants for Thursday's discussion. And so is there any pertinent discussion right now before we move this? Senator Jungbauer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess to Senator Anderson, I'm getting taken aback by hearing this. Wind integration study makes assumptions because every bit of science on global warming and how we're going to solve it makes way more assumptions than the wind integration study ever does. So I get frustrated hearing that. And we do all have the political will to move forward, but I think that this gives us more of a framework than other things that you might have authored or others might have authored. And I don't think anybody, and it doesn't matter, you know, this is where I get angry because it doesn't matter where I fall on the science of global warming. Anything man puts into the water, the land, or the air that is a pollutant or is causing any kind of harm, I agree always 100%. Let us do something about that. But we're looking across all sectors here. We're getting all kinds of input to come back with some real answers to give us more choices rather than going after one segment or another segment. And I don't think there's any problem with the political will here. So it's when you talk about assumptions, there's so many assumptions out there.
Senator Rosen. Okay, Senator Anderson.
Well, Mr. Chair, I was just going to say, you know, one of the points that I've tried to make in my bill is that as we, and I agree with you, I strongly support the Climate Strategies Group process. I think it could come back with some very useful ideas. Whether it creates political will, we'll see. I hope so. But part of what the purpose of what I was trying to do in my bill is to say, okay, let's take a step back. Let's look at all the information. Let's make some recommendations. But in the meantime, let's do no harm. Let's not dig ourselves into a deeper hole between now and then. And that's one of my concerns, which we are not addressing here.
Senator Jungbauer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Senator Anderson. Also, I get frustrated. I read stuff like this editorial, global warming, it's here and it will get worse. Because this editorial shows the lack of knowledge of the person that wrote it. Every IPCC report, and I've read them all, goes downhill. It's less and less in each report of what they're predicting. And some of the other stuff that people are talking about in here or around the Capitol shows that most people don't even have a clue what the global warming theory is about. And I get frustrated. Maybe we need to start from that and bring in actually what the global warming theory is about, how global warming works, when you'll notice the temperature differences, because it has nothing to do with what people banty about in the legislature. Nothing to do with that is anything close to the global warming theory.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm just going to cut my comments short, but just a couple things that were said that I think need to be addressed is that, as Senator Prettner-Solon said, the four-prong approach. And we have been very responsible in this committee. We have adopted that four-prong approach, and we've passed some very good legislation. And I think we should all keep that in mind, that we have had the political will, and we have moved forward. So this bill is being very prudent and being very responsible because I don't want to see our state just survive. I want to see our state thrive. And that's why in this bill on page 8, line 25, it says the evaluation must consider rate impacts on energy consumers in the state. Well, that is something that we have not addressed very well in the first two pieces of legislation that we passed. And it's time to get a handle on what it's costing our ratepayers. So this is something that I feel very strongly about, being responsible. We are moving forward. We have a lot of questions that need to be addressed, and that's and one of them is how much is it going to cost? I think that's one of the parts of the equation.
Yes.
Okay. Senator Rummel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Senator. I think this question is really directed at Mr. Fuller. During one of our stakeholder meetings, we talked about whether or not we would be, while we wait for this study to happen, are we putting a cap on the current emissions that utilities are releasing or they're we were told that it's only 10 months and we can wait for 10 months. Can the utilities wait 10 months before they add on additional carbon producing plants?
Mr. Fuller.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator Rummel, I think that the Section 5, the moratorium, whatever you want to call it, the backsliding sort of concern, it was directed at two facilities that are currently in process. One would be Big Stone, which is trying to get a certificate of need for transmission lines, and the other is Mesaba, which is trying to get a power purchase agreement. My best guess is that, certainly with respect to Big Stone, they will not be generating any greenhouse gases by next year, and they'll probably be, it's assured to be tied up in the legal aspect of that process at that time. That's almost a certainty. I'm not as sure about what the status of Excelsior or Mesaba will be, but they certainly won't be producing any greenhouse gases. So, no, I don't think a delay will necessarily even probably involve any increased greenhouse gas between now and next session, because I don't think there'll be any additional facilities, at least in Minnesota. There may be some importation of power on the edges, but I don't think there would be necessarily a large increase in greenhouse gases.
Well, Mr. Chair, Mr.
Senator Anderson.
Mr. Fuller, just to clarify, what I was talking about would include approval of a new facility that generates carbon dioxide emissions. So, I mean, my bill wouldn't stop approval, but it would have said if it is going to move forward and be approved, then there has to be a plan to offset those emissions. And so that, of course, wouldn't happen under this plan.
Mr. Fuller.
Well, as the Mr. Chairman and members, as the bill sits in the House, mm-hmm. it allows energy to be provided to a steel mill outside of the cap, and it allows for, it exempts natural gas-fired peaking plants. So it's, I think the concern is that if you, well, you want an opinion? Okay. The concern would be that if you are, in a sense, barring some things but trading for that by allowing some other things, those other things might not be the things you want to end up with at the end of the day.
Well, Mr. Chair, Mr. Fuller,
Senator Anderson,
Senator Fuller, we might not agree with the House version of the bill. The point was that we're trying to stop more generation that will be around for years and years to come without a plan to reduce them.
Yeah. Senator Dibble.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I was feeling slightly defensive. I think we did deal well with the subject of rates, at least in the efficiency bill. Senator Rosen, just I have to point out that we've built in all kinds of provisions and assurances that the conservation and efficiency measures that were called for in that bill have to save money for ratepayers and utilities, and otherwise they don't proceed. And of course I have the confidence of the policy positions that we took in making those statements because it's well known that efficiency is far and away the more cost-effective way to pursue energy rather than building more or sourcing more energy sources. So we did, at least in one bill, deal quite explicitly and deliberately with the impact of rates on the consumers.
Okay, we're going to have all day on Thursday to continue this discussion. So, and a while ago, I think Senator Pretner Solon moved to adopt the A2 delete all amendment. And is there any further discussion on that? Seeing none, I'd like to move to adopt the A2 delete all amendment. All in favor, say aye.
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 All opposed? The motion is adopted. And seeing that there's no further business, we'll adjourn this meeting until Thursday when we'll take the Senate File 145 up.